You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio. I don't know how I've gone this long without having him on here yet, Rob Call. Rob Call is an inventor, a journalist, the founder of opednews.com, where I have blogged for years and years, and where Rob himself has posted thousands of articles. Rob also hosts the Bottom Up radio show, and we will be talking about what bottom up means. This is a show that airs on WNJC, I believe, and online, and via Pacifica and other outlets. In 2014, Mediaite showed Rob Call ranked as one of the top 200 print and online columnists. Rob Call, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you on. I don't know how I've gone this long without it. We'll have to have you back on as soon as I can. And I wanna learn about this concept of bottom up, because you've had me on your show recently and asked me about this, and I couldn't answer your questions. So I think we'll go to the expert. What is bottom up?
Well, most people have heard about bottom up in the progressive world because Bernie Sanders, just about every one of his stump speeches, would say change doesn't happen from the top down, it happens from the bottom up. And it ends up Hillary Clinton has said it, Barack Obama has said it, John Kasich, Ronald Reagan, George Bush. It's a really commonly used term, and Google Trends shows that people are using it more and more. But what is it beyond what Bernie says? Most people think about it as being related to grassroots. And I started thinking about it because I built opednews.com, my site, which is a community blogging site that has published over 100,000 articles over the years. I started taking a more bottom-up approach to it, which means I started being less hierarchical, less authoritarian, and attempted to bring in the users, the readers, the writers, the volunteer editors more and more in participating in making decisions. And it got me thinking, what is bottom-up?
What have been the advantages of that?
Well, the site grew, and it got better, and it worked better, and it worked smarter, and it worked fairer, and people agreed that it was a good thing to do that. And it wasn't perfect. I run it, but I try to do it with a bottom-up intention, trying to include people in making the decisions. So before making major decisions, very often there'd be an article that would come out, and we'd get hundreds of comments discussing the considerations involved. And just about any major decisions on the site are decided with volunteer editors. So that got me started thinking about it. And so I started a radio show because I was fascinated by it, and I saw that it could make things better. And with the radio show, I started interviewing all kinds of different people with different takes on bottom-up. And the basic premise of the radio show, Bottom-Up Radio, is that we live in a primarily top-down world, but it's becoming more bottom-up because the Internet and smartphones have catalyzed us to be more bottom-up. And the reason that they've been so powerful in making these changes that include trillions of dollars in new businesses, taking down of dictators, electing presidents, changing the way people relate with each other, destroying industries, starting new industries. The reason it's been so powerful in such a short period of time is because humans evolved to live bottom-up lives. 99% of the existence of humans, they lived in small hunter-gatherer bands, not even tribes. Bands of 50 to 100 people generally. And they treated each other differently, they saw the world differently, and they acted differently. And if you want to get an idea of how they acted, they acted the way that indigenous Aboriginal people act. Now, currently, most indigenous and Aboriginal people live in bigger social milieus. They live in tribes, if they're even living there. I mean, there are still a couple hundred thousand, maybe a couple million people living that way. But they're few and far spread and far between, and there are very, very few who are not in touch with modern civilization. And the history of modern Western civilization has been to have the goal of destroying indigenous Aboriginal cultures and to do it aggressively and very destructively. For example, in different countries, when the Christian controllers have come, what they've done is they've taken the children of Aboriginals and put them with Christian families so that they would literally wipe out the parental transfer of culture.
Including in this country.
In this country, Canada, Australia, and then they're lucky, because a lot of times they come and they just kill people. 90% of them in the case of South America. What? A lot of it by disease. What? But, you know, the thing is, bottom up is so much more than just grassroots. If you take it from the roots of the idea that indigenous Aboriginal people, the way they live and the way hunter-gatherers live, well, then you have a collection of characteristics. Now, it's kind of easier to start because we know so well the top-down characteristics, hierarchy, centralization, authoritarianism, domination. These are some of the biggest, most powerful, paternalism. These are some of the most powerful aspects of the top-down culture. And these appeared primarily when farming and the domestication of animals and land happened originally maybe 8 to 12,000 years ago. That led to civilization, and it kind of hit me once. I was giving a talk to my kid's class when he was like in third grade. It's a long time ago, 27 now. And they were talking about civilization, and I pointed out, yeah, that's when slavery was created. Well, slavery was created with civilization and hierarchy and paternalism. And I mean patriarchy.
I got one more for you, Rob. War.
Yeah. War. Yeah. Yeah.
Same time. So obviously we can't undo the genocides of the past centuries, and we have on the one hand this trend of various politicians saying the phrase bottom up. On the other hand, we have the trend of incredibly increased concentration of wealth and power and militarization of government and police, and scholars concluding the United States is clearly an oligarchy, not a representative government. How do we apply bottom-up ideas to governing ourselves at a large scale, or can it not be done and we have to break things up into smaller scales, or what's the practical application?
Well, first thing is to recognize that you are a bottom-up being, that you have hundreds of different genetic factors that are basically programmed into you to function in a bottom-up way. The problem is civilization represses an awful lot of them. And the good news is the internet and all these bottom-up technological things are pushing the buttons and activating them, some of them long dead. So there's hope that just that alone is going to move things in the right direction. Once you wake up to the idea that you are a bottom-up being, then you can embrace it and you can decide that that's the way you want to see the world and that's the way you want to function. Bottom-up is a collection of different things. Bottom-up is interdependence, caring, cooperation, transparency. I've got long lists that I've put together, and they oppose, and for every one of them, there's a top-down opposite to it. So you know, for transparency, it's secrecy, for interdependence, there's domination, and the list goes on and on. But once you decide that you want to be a bottom-up person, there are a couple of really basic concepts. One is we're all connected to each other, to nature. And so you can go a little bit beyond the golden rule. I like this idea called connection consciousness, which basically is that you recognize that we're all connected to everything and everybody. So the golden rule says, do unto others as you would do unto yourself. I say, we're all us. There are no others. We're all one. So we have to treat ourselves. And that's the big our in a good way. So if you can develop a kind of a bottom-up value system, then you look at things in a different way. And you look at people who are controllers. You look at laws that say that local people can't make decisions. Like, for example, there's that the law that says that states can't require the labeling of foods as GMO or non-GMO. Well, that's a law that is a top-down law that allows local people to make decisions. Bottom-up is local. Top-down is centralized. And it's really important that we get back to local. Globalization is top-down. The opposite of it is engaging in and embracing as much as possible a local economy. Now, the thing is, there's no way that we can attack the biggest, most powerful forces directly. But if you look at the history of the planet, the dinosaurs were the biggest forces, and the ecosystem changed, and they died, and the little small mammals, they became the most powerful forces. And I think that what we have to do is develop alternative systems and live with those and embrace them. For example, you go to the supermarket, identify whole aisles of processed foods made by these transnational corporations that you're not going to do any business with. Just stop dealing with them. And you can take an approach like that, go to your local farmer's market, join co-ops, and get involved at local levels in ways that can make a big difference. Now, this applies in so many ways. Now, for example, Trump has basically decreed that he's going to use hard power. Hard power is weapons and money, and he's defunding soft power, which is the bottom-up kind of power. Soft power attracts people, and the kind of things that produce soft power are arts and stories, helping people, like building bridges and schools, eradicating diseases. These are soft power approaches that help people and make a difference, and you get them to do what you want by attracting them. So there's so many ways to think about bottom-up that you can use personally. Now, yeah. One thing that I'm really excited about is top-down also applies to science. The model of science that was used for hundreds of years was Newtonian and Cartesian, and the idea was that you broke things down into parts and you assembled them. And this worked for a lot of stuff. It worked for basic physics and basic chemistry, but it didn't work for subatomic particles. It didn't work for complex chemical reactions, and it certainly doesn't work for biological systems and ecosystems. So in the mid-20th century, they started a new kind of science, and they call it systems theory. And what systems theory, which is a collection of ideas that includes nonlinear dynamics and chaos theory, what they basically say is that for science to work, you look at relationships and you look at patterns. And the nonlinear part of it means you don't look at straight lines. You look at the way things go in cycles, and there are no straight lines. Matter of fact, straight lines are top-down. Go to a small country, and you see all the curvy, crazy roads, and that's bottom-up. You look at giant highways, those are top-down, big ways to get from one place to another. So what is exciting, though, is in this new scientific model, what it basically has is a different way of looking at the way change happens. Change happens when systems develop new cycles, and those cycles repeat themselves, and they branch off in new directions, and they're called emergent properties. Now, the thing is with emergent properties within systems, things can very rapidly change. And one guy won a Nobel Prize for his work with this, which showed that you can have a lot of craziness, a lot of chaos, and then when it quiets down, you have higher levels of order. And that I learned that about 30 years ago. And frankly, it's kind of comforted me that there can be chaos, and then you know that there can be higher levels of order that come out of that. But the thing for activists is, in the mechanistic Newtonian Cartesian point of view, you have to just pile lots of stuff on, and it's quantity that counts. In the systems view, the patterns and the cycles can change, and a small little pattern can develop that can reverberate at multiple fractal levels, and you can get huge changes in a very quick time. And to me, that's a really exciting thing, because it means that it doesn't take 10 or 20 or 100% of the population to make changes happen. It can be a very small spark that sets things off.
It can indeed. We're speaking with Rob Call, who is the founder and editor at opednews.com, a wonderful website that I'm sure you're familiar with, but if you aren't, go check it out. Rob, one recent activist effort that comes to mind, relatively recent, when you're talking this way, is Occupy, which of course took on the 1% of the country. And you've been writing about taking on the billionaires, de-billionarizing the planet and the country. Can you talk a little bit about how that relates to bottom-up and how you go about it?
Absolutely. Well, I think that big is top-down, and too big is not a part of nature. Nature does not like giantism. Matter of fact, nature treats giantism as a disease, and giants tend to die, or they just don't exist. They're born dead very often. I think that what we have with billionaires is people who are anomalies within our culture and our economic system, and I think they're dangerous. Even the best-intentioned billionaire is too powerful, both by influence, access, and money. And I think that we need to pass laws that make it impossible to become a billionaire and stay a billionaire. The easiest way to start is to deal with inheritance. No person should be born on third base with $1 billion or even hundreds of millions of dollars. We've got to create dynasty taxes, you know, the right calls them death taxes, but I call them dynasty taxes. We've got to prevent dynasties from happening. There's no reason that some child or adult child of a billionaire should be handed huge amounts of money. I also don't think that anybody needs to have $100 or $150 million home or yacht or painting. There's no reason for that. And I believe that we've seen how Trump is lining his cabinet with billionaires. It's a bad thing. Now, Trump has just recently said that he doesn't think that poor people should be in some of these jobs. Well, I wonder what poor means to him, having less than $1 million, less than $100 million. So you start off by taxing billionaires who die and not allowing their families to have the kind of extreme wealth. Then you create laws that basically say, okay, you did something brilliant and great. You should be rewarded for it, but that doesn't mean that you get to be a billionaire. Maybe you should have $100 million or $50 million, but not $1 billion, not a half $1 billion. So if you're starting to make that kind of money, then you're going to have to do something with it. good idea. Share it with your employees. Share it with the people who helped you to make it, because nobody becomes a billionaire on their own.
Are you talking, Rob, about local laws, state laws, or national laws, or something else?
Yeah. All of them. I think it's important to do it on a national level. And I know this is really, you know, most people hear me say this and they think I'm crazy, that I'm discouraging innovation and creativity. But I do believe that billionaires are dangerous.
I'm with you 1,000%, Robin. Been there for decades. But we started out this interview with, we got to go local. National laws are top down and dangerous and too much power. And so what happens when you have a misguided state or locality that wants billionaires and the federal government says no? Is that not top down?
Well, there's a balance. You know, I I've been involved in the world of positive psychology for a really long time, since the early 80s. And I ran the first conference on positive psychology. I have positivepsychology.net as a website. It needs to be updated, but I've had it for a long time. And when I got into positive psychology in the early 80s, like, there were, you know, hundreds of thousands of psychologists who were focused on pathology, diagnosing disease and fixing disease. And I thought, well, how much can you do to help people, not by dealing with the disease, but by helping them to become stronger, to become smarter, to become happier, to have more skills that would brighten their lives? And I wasn't saying get rid of the negative stuff. I was saying, how much can you do to move in that positive direction? And I think the same thing can apply to bottom up. Yes, top down is going to exist, and you're not going to get rid of it altogether, and you need it in some ways. But how many ways can you look at something and think, well, there's a better bottom-up way of doing it, or this top-down way is too much? So it's a matter of shifting the balance. We live in a culture that is predominantly top-down. We want it to be a lot more bottom-up. For example, there are now over 300 companies that have gotten rid of hierarchical management, including a billion-dollar company that's owned by Amazon, Zappos. So there are real possibilities for ways that we can do things. I think what we, you know, the thing is, you got to challenge everything, which is a bottom-up idea. You know, top-down is didactic, and bottom-up is question and get into dialogue. And this is Paulo Freire's approach. He wrote that best-selling book about looking at education as a way that you change and have revolution happen. You've got a good question. It's a good question. There's a problem with centralized top-down laws, but sometimes you need to do that too.
Yeah, no, it's a good answer. What do you think of the idea of a maximum wage? You know, pick a number, 10 or 20. You can't have more income than 20 times, a minimum wage worker makes, and is, if you want to raise the maximum wage, just raise the minimum wage. Good idea for a law?
Well, the way some co-ops do it is they say that the maximum that management can make is a certain multiplier of what the lowest paid worker can
make. Yeah.
And I think that's not a bad idea. You know, I've really spent a lot of time looking at psychopaths, sociopaths, and narcissists also, and done a lot of interviews on it and a lot of articles on it. And if you look at indigenous cultures, and I'm really interested in indigenous cultures because I think they have so much to teach us about how to get back to the bottom-up way of our forebears, how would they treat a billionaire? How would they treat somebody who attempted to control and own 50% of the assets of the band or tribe? So I asked the person who was at the time the president of one of the societies studying psychopaths. He gave as an example, well, if it was up in upper reaches in North America, the indigenous people there, some call them Eskimos, they would take him and put him out on an ice floe. In other words, kill him.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not saying to kill anybody, but I'm saying you don't put up with that. You don't put up with it ever. and that nobody should have that much power and be that selfish. And I think that we can learn from them that the idea of you know, an income is one thing. And the thing is, people don't get income when they invent things. Invention is wonderful. I'm an inventor. I invented something, a biofeedback ring that I've sold over 500,000 of. It didn't get me rich, but it helped me buy my first house. And that was great. But, you know, when somebody comes up with a business and it starts making them billions of dollars, and a lot of them are these hedge fund people, and what they come up with is an algorithm. That's just too much. And we have to speak up and say, no more billionaires, and get rid of the ones that we have. And, you know...
Yeah, but get rid of them by taxing their money away, which I'm all for, or get rid of them by sticking them out on an ice floe. There's kind of a difference.
I'm not saying to stick... No, I don't want to hurt anybody. What I want to do is I want to change their power. And you do that by saying, you're not allowed to have that kind of money. Here are a collection of options that you have. First one, share it with your employees. Share it with the community that you developed that wealth in. Create charitable organizations that are publicly run, not that you and your wife run. You know, there's a handful of billionaires who say they're going to give it away, but then they control entirely all the money,
yeah.
And I don't buy that. I don't accept that. You know, Bill Gates and Mark Zuckerberg, I'm sorry, but, you know, that's just not enough. You know, thank you for creating what you did. Good job, but you don't deserve to have that $60 million or $60 billion or $80 billion.
Yeah.
You know, I go to the teller machine and I take out $40, $100, $200. Mark Zuckerberg just cashed in $42 million of shares. And he has 400 million shares, some insane amount that adds up to $60 billion.
Yeah.
So it was pocket change for him.
Imagine, Rob, we've got about 1 minute left. Imagine you taxed all the money away from the billionaires and you got about $1 trillion. That's about how much you could take away from the U.S. military budget each year. Year after year after year after year.
Amen.
So the billionaires...
Well, we didn't get into it, but...
Yeah, go ahead. We got... 30 seconds.
Get into it, but war is top down. The idea is that a handful of people are going to declare war, and you know the answer to war is develop soft power and use soft power techniques and approaches to convince people to do things differently.
I couldn't agree more. We're speaking with Rob Call. He is the founder of opednews.com. You can find him there. I know he'll be speaking at the Democracy Convention this summer, where I will be as well, democracyconvention.org. And he has a book in the works on this topic. Is that right, Rob?
Yes, Bottom Up, The Connection Revolution.
I'm very much looking forward to reading it. Rob Call, thank you for everything you do and for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks for having me.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the Democratic Republic of Congo is embroiled in economic crisis as well as the humanitarian disaster of violence between the government of Joseph Kabila and opposition forces. Elite U.S. media give you a tired tale of a perennially war-torn African nation, with benevolent outsiders like the U.S. looking to help. You're right to suspect that reality is something different. Maurice Carney, co-founder and executive director of the group Friends of the Congo, will join us to talk about what's going on. Also on the show, a July Washington Post poll finds one out of every three Washington, D.C. residents say they've taken part in a protest against the president since his inauguration. That number includes half of the district's white residents, half of people making more than $100,000 a year, and a fifth of respondents over the age of 65. As more people go out in the street, states are rushing to criminalize that resistance. We'll talk about the right to protest and the role of law in a time of widespread dissent with activist attorney Mara Verheyden-Hilliard, executive director of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund. That's coming up, but first we'll take a quick look back at recent press. The New York Times is again spreading the myth that House Speaker Paul Ryan and other Republicans want a free market in healthcare. As economist Dean Baker writes, pointing to an op-ed describing Ryan as a believer in free market medicine, it's certainly helpful to the Republicans to imply that they're trying to advance some grand principle as opposed to just giving money to rich people, but it's a lie. There are, Baker points out, no government-granted patent monopolies in a free market, but we've got them. And as a result, Americans will pay more than $440 billion for prescription drugs this year, drugs that would likely cost less than $80 billion in a free market. The same for medical equipment. MRIs are cheap without patent protection. Now, you can argue that government-granted monopolies are good if you want to, but you can't deny that they're policy, and you can't pretend that that's the free market at work. The U.S. pays doctors twice as much as their counterparts in other rich countries and protects them from competition, representing some $80 billion a year in higher health care costs. Paul Ryan has never indicated any desire to change the policies that inflate the costs of drugs and equipment. So in pretending that Republicans are motivated by some philosophy in their efforts to repeal the ACA, the New York Times is doing them a favor, but none for its readers, who have enough malarkey to deal with as it is. A recent New York Times story on the opiate epidemic used the word crime twice and the word death six times, but the word medication didn't appear. It's important, Michael Corcoran wrote for FAIR.org, that a story about the dangers of overdose makes no reference to any of the pharmaceuticals that are widely accepted as most effective at reducing overdoses. Buprenorphine, Suboxone, methadone. The word treatment does appear near the story's end. It's placed on equal footing with law enforcement in a phrase about how drug interdiction and treatment are critical in addressing the crisis. Well, it's obvious that corporate media coverage of the opioid crisis, identified as affecting overwhelmingly white people, is categorically different from their coverage of crack. We're not hearing about a bio-underclass or how the drug's use interferes with the central core of what it is to be human. But the supposedly more humane approach to a drug crisis with a white face only goes so far. A senatorial press conference highlighting the impact of Trump care on the crisis drew media crickets. And a 2015 study found that media still generally ignore public health solutions and focus mostly on criminality. Worse are stories that actually demonize treatment, like an NPR piece from June that moved quickly past the idea that Suboxone, when used correctly, can help addicts recover, to get to the story's point, but it has a dark side. And that was that some doctors are selling the drug illegally. Well, Suboxone is non-euphoric when used by patients with a tolerance to opiates, but you wouldn't guess that from a piece that plays up the dangers but doesn't talk much about effectiveness. Numerous studies have shown medication-assisted treatment reducing overdose deaths by 80% in France, 75% in Australia, 66% in Baltimore. But media have found an angle they like. Addiction experts and advocates cite things like the New York Times report from 2013 that declared buprenorphine, quote, has become both medicine and dope, close quote. And one a few weeks later that bemoaned a homeless mother's methadone maintenance treatment as just a, quote, substitute addiction, close quote. A letter writer explained to the paper that these kinds of stories just push shame on people who are already struggling with the feeling that their recovery doesn't count. Those stories are also unsurprisingly abetting Republican anti-science politicians, like HHS Secretary Tom Price, who recently declared, against the findings of his own agency, that maintenance drugs are just, quote, substituting one opioid for another, close quote. Funnily enough, NPR was able to identify that as an unscientific view when it came from a Trump appointee. And finally, longtime fair friend Jack Shaheen died July 10th. We see clearly how people are misled by media depictions of Arabs and Muslims as backward and violent, and how those views help fuel continuing militarism in the Mideast. As Fair Associate Sam Husseini wrote, the importance of those denigrating images and stereotypes was what made Jack Shaheen's work so vital. A journalism professor at Southern Illinois University and author of The TV Arab, Real Bad Arabs, How Hollywood Vilifies a People, which was made into a documentary film, and Guilty, Hollywood's Verdict on Arabs After 9/11, Shaheen was a humanist to the core. He warned about the creation of, quote, the character whom we hate and we detest, who is subhuman, who is different from you and me, close quote. As a consultant for TV and film, he argued for more presence and participation of Arabs, Muslims, and others unfairly depicted, and he stressed the importance of academics and activists engaging media producers early in the creative process, something he practiced with a unique, gentle tenacity. Shaheen's love of film grew from his childhood when his mother, a Lebanese immigrant, worked as a cashier at a movie house in Pittsburgh, and he often cited the support of his wife, Bernice. We'll miss him. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. The fighting between the coalitions of President Joseph Kabila, who refused to step down December 19th as the Constitution mandates, and opposition forces is devastating the Democratic Republic of Congo. The UN has just reported 80,000 people fleeing the latest fighting in Fizi territory, joining nearly 4 million people already uprooted by violence. In the central Kasai region, the Catholic Church reports more than 3,300 people killed since October. Accounts include two-year-olds with limbs chopped off and babies with machete wounds, as well as whole villages destroyed. And now the fighting is being presented as reason to postpone elections still further. Like other African nations, Congo is of limited and irregular interest to U.S. media. That isn't justified by the scale of the crisis the country is enduring. More than 5 million people have died since 1998 from violence and mostly from hunger and disease faced while trying to flee violence. Nor can U.S. media plausibly claim that the U.S. isn't implicated in Congo's hardship, though you'd be hard-pressed to understand the U.S. role, past or present, from media accounts. Here to help us understand what's happening is Maurice Carney, co-founder and executive director of the group Friends of the Congo. He joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome back to Counterspin, Maurice Carney.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you for having us.
Well, the current violence between the government coalition and opposition forces that's having such a shattering impact on the people, is that connected or how much is it connected to Kabila's refusal to step down last December?
Well, the overall instability in the country is overwhelmingly due to the fact that President Kabila wants to stay in power and stay in power by any means necessary. This is critical for people to understand that you have a president whose term is expired, but yet he wants to remain in power against the will of the people and in contradistinction to the constitution of the country. So that's really the crux of the instability in the country today. And when you have this leader that lacks legitimacy, local issues that would normally remain local issues, they're quickly escalated to be national issues. Those are disputes that you find that occur locally. The federal government, the national government, usually intervenes on one side or the other. And the question then becomes, are you in support of the president or against the president? And when you have a grouping or formations that are against the interests of the president, then the president and the Kabila regime itself sends in military forces to try and clamp down on any kind of dissension that we may see. And this is what has been the source of the issue in the Kasai, for example, the region that you mentioned at the outset.
Yes, what happened in Kasai was that a traditional leader, they tried to remove him and folks protested?
Yes, a traditional leader who was supposed to assume the position of chief. However, this leader was against the Kabila regime and against the way the government had been running things. So the federal government, through the Ministry of Interior, tried to intervene in what was a traditional process and intervened to the point where they wound up killing the chief. And this spiraled out of control to where the followers of the chief then started to resist by any means that they could. They saw that the chief had been killed, and it was done at the behest of the Congolese government, and the people were not going to stand for that. And in an effort to show that the government was in control, the regime was in control, the Kabila regime sent in military forces that, as you stated at the outset, were killing women, children, babies, and even, many believe, played a role in the assassination of two United Nations investigators who had gone in to document the crimes that were being committed in the Kasai region. Recently this week, the United Nations reported that there are some 80-plus mass graves that have been found in the region as a result of the instability.
Well, when the Washington Post reported in late June on the reports which came from the Catholic Church, which has been doing this research on the killings in Kasai, they told the story, and then when it was time to give some context, the Washington Post said this, quote, "Wars and explosive ethnic rivalries have riven Congo for decades, reaching a peak in the 1990s and 2000s when conflict in neighboring Rwanda spilled across the border," close quote. That strikes me as incomplete, to say it nicely.
Oh, yeah, totally incomplete. In fact, not only the Washington Post, BBC, and other corporate media, they lead with the ethnic narrative. And at the core, this is a political question, and not solely a political question, but also a geopolitical one. And because you have President Kabila, who has been supported by the West since 2001 when he took over from his father. They stood behind him in 2011 when he cheated in the election and basically appropriated what was a fraudulent election. So they've backed Kabila for the last 16 years. And now when Kabila wants to stay, he's developed such strength that it's difficult for him to step down or for the people to remove him from power. So the West has been complicit in the situation that we see today. In fact, we see the West, some of the nations in the West who are trying to impose sanctions on Kabila, and we're saying, well, they're the arsonists. How can they be, you know, the firefighters today? So that's really critical for people to understand that Kabila has benefited. He has been strengthened by his support from the West over the last decade and a half.
Yes, there's a very strange feeling when you read Nikki Haley, our UN representative, saying that the United States is extremely interested in a democratic transfer of power in Congo.
What you'll see in the media, you'll often see that it's said that there hasn't been a peaceful transfer of power in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And there's a part that's left off of that. There hasn't been a peaceful transfer in the Democratic Republic of Congo since the United States overthrew the first democratically elected leader in the country. That was Patrice Emery Lumumba in 1960, one of Congo's independence hero and first democratically elected prime minister. And since that time, every leader that has risen to power in the Congo has done so with the backing of the United States. There hasn't been a leader since Lumumba who's assumed power without the backing of the United States. So if you're listening audience, it's important for them to understand the role that the West and the United States in particular has played in what has transpired in the Congo. And part of the reason for the destructive role that Western institutions and nations have played is because of Congo's tremendous wealth. It's a storehouse of precious and strategic minerals that are vital to major industries in the West. Even today, one of the burgeoning industries is the automotive industry, the green industry, where we're seeing more electric cars like Tesla and Prius and others. Well, Congo has a key mineral that's vital to the functioning of that industry, and that's a cobalt. And Congo is the largest producer of cobalt, largest reserves of cobalt, and it is one of the hottest mineral on the market today. So that's part of the reason why there's so much interest in what happens in the Congo from the corporate sector in particular in the West.
Well, I just wanted to ask you finally, I know that Friends of the Congo has been taking part in demonstrations there in D.C. and the Women's March and the various marches since the inauguration in which you are bringing together these global concerns and concern with what's happening in the DRC and local concerns. And you see every reason to see connections there between the economic and political struggles we have here and what's happening there. I mean, is that the way forward?
Oh, absolutely, and it's probably best exemplified by the social justice movement we see unfolding in the Congo today among Congolese youth. The organizing and the mobilizing that we see in the streets of the United States, they're happening in the Democratic Republic of Congo as well, where young people are standing up. However, and unfortunately, the stakes are much higher in the Congo because the police has been equipped in part by the United States, the Congolese police. They shoot to kill. They jail young people at the drop of a hat. In fact, as I'm speaking to you today, we have two of our young people, Jean-Marie Kalonji and Silva Mbakai, who were picked up by the Congolese military and placed into a detention camp. And they've been there since June 23rd for 3 weeks now. And we don't know why. They haven't done anything. These are young people who provide services to the local community, like the Black Lives Matter movement here has the bail project where they bail mothers out of jail. Mm-hmm. That's what the youth are doing in the Congo. They go in and they bail mothers and their babies out of jail. They provide services to the handicapped community, and they provide scholarships to young people. They support education and health of their communities. But yet, they've been picked up and placed into a military detention camp. So the kind of resistance that you see here in the U.S. also exists there. And that's really critical for people who are here in the movement to understand that the issues are not fundamentally different, and that what Dr. King said is so true when he stated that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And it's the injustices that the youth in the Congo are fighting, and they're not fundamentally different from the injustices that are being fought here in the United States.
We've been speaking with Maurice Carney of Friends of the Congo. You can find their work online at friendsofthecongo.org, and they're on Twitter at Congo Friends. Thank you so much, Maurice Carney, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
A recent popular op-ed called on those engaged in resisting the Trump administration to stop counting so much on lawyers. The fate of the nation cannot be left in the hands of the courts, the piece, written by a lawyer, argued, and that's solid advice. Popular action is what historically has moved the country forward. But when people do go into the street and are then arrested, what then? When they put their bodies on the line and the state creates a new law to criminalize that resistance, what then? Like it or not, the law is still one of the bigger tools in the box for Americans. So what does and doesn't it do for us in the present moment? Mara Verheyden-Hilliard is an activist and attorney. She's co-founder and executive director of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund. She joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome back to Counterspin, Mara Verheyden-Hilliard.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I'd like to start, if we could, with an update on the J20, those arrested in inauguration protests in D.C., who are facing what I've heard called unprecedented charges for demonstrators, felony charges that could lead to 75, 80 years in prison. One of those still facing charges is journalist Aaron Cantu, now at the Santa Fe Reporter, who has written for FAIR. We talked about the case in January. What should we know now about this ongoing story?
This case is really of extraordinary proportions when you look at what the government is doing to people who are engaged in protest on the first day that Trump took office. And it's really, in its own context, significant, too, because of the major shift in policing in Washington, D.C., which we believe is intended to send a signal. What's happened now is more than 200 people were swept up in a dragnet arrest by the police. And this occurred after the police had followed the demonstration for, by their own account, approximately a half an hour, while there were some people who broke windows, only a handful of people. And rather than going in and arresting the people for whom they had probable cause to arrest, the police waited and at an arbitrary time trapped and detained 200 people. And so they swept up demonstrators, passersby, journalists, anyone who was in proximity, anyone who was chanting and protesting. And then they undertook this mass prosecution with the United States Attorney's Office here in the District of Columbia, in which people are being threatened with, as you've mentioned, jail time that is decades and decades long, really a lifetime of jail time with these felony charges. They are charging people en masse with crimes that may have happened in terms of property damage, but charging everyone with crimes without particularized probable cause, without being able to point to a person and say, you committed this act, and so we're charging you for this act. They're charging everyone in the vicinity for being in proximity. This is extremely dangerous. It sets the stage that for any demonstration, if anyone commits a criminal act, an act of property damage, whether that be a protester or, frankly, a police agent provocateur, the police can now use this as license, or they wish to sweep up everyone else around them.
Well, this is what we talked about before. It's not a crime now, is it, to be in proximity to other people who break the law in conjunction with First Amendment activities?
Of course it's not, and it cannot be. And the First Amendment has always stood for that, in fact, you cannot criminalize a person for the acts of another, and particularly in the context of the First Amendment, when it's an issue where the connection is that there may be a sympathy of political views, one cannot do that. There are cases dating back, NAACP v. Claiborne Hardware and others, the court said you have to act with precision. You cannot say that just because people have a similar point of view or may have similar political goals, that those who carry out illegal acts or acts of violence in pursuit of those goals, that those acts can be attributed to the others who do not.
Right. These charges at the level they're at, it feels new. But we know that the effort to repress First Amendment expression is not new. The Supreme Court last month rejected a First Amendment case that dates from years back, Garcia v. Bloomberg. Can you tell us about that and how it relates?
The Garcia v. Bloomberg case comes from the Occupy demonstration of 2011 when 700 people were peacefully marching, compliant with police orders. There was no violence, and as people marched, the police escorted the march. The police themselves closed the Brooklyn Bridge roadway to vehicular traffic. The police and police commanders themselves opened up the roadway to pedestrian traffic. It is the police and police commanders who led the demonstrators onto the roadway of the Brooklyn Bridge. And once those demonstrators had flowed and followed behind the lead of the police stopped the march, trapped them from behind, mass arrested 700 people. When we litigated this case, we won at the district court level. We won at the Second Circuit, in fact. And then Mayor de Blasio, who had taken office, frankly, running on an Occupy ticket, had the court reevaluate the ruling, and the court, in an extraordinary measure, reversed itself. And we took this case up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court just last month determined that they would not hear it.
Obviously, lots of folks are taking their lead from this and kind of joining on this bandwagon. We have a spate of anti-protest legislation around the country. Even UN experts are issuing alarmed statements now. Some 20 states have passed or tried to pass laws allowing protesters to be charged with conspiracy, increasing penalties for blocking streets, even protecting drivers who run protesters over, banning masks and hoodies. I mean, is anyone really confused that the intent of these rules is to quash dissent? And doesn't that thinly veiled intent matter?
It's clear that there is an effort around the country to try and, through legal means, although we would consider them illegal means, curtail people's fundamental First Amendment rights to gather together in the streets, to be able to speak out in unified action. I do think, as much as we're seeing these kinds of restrictions imposed and these rulings that at the same time it can obviously have a chilling effect on people, the reality is that people do always come out, and people will continue to come out. And while this may be intended to have a chilling effect, it is really crucial that people stand up and speak out for what they believe in. And I do think the reason that we're seeing these is because there is a growing recognition that there really is this fire of people, these embers burning, where we keep seeing people come up and demonstrating for what they believe in. We're seeing so many more people entering political life, even since the election of Donald Trump. People are taking the streets and protesting who never protested before. So while we're faced with what is, I think, overt repression, both in terms of these felony prosecutions, these state laws, these court rulings, we also are faced with the fact that there are millions of people who are engaging in political protest and political organizing who have never done so before. And that's a force that really can't be stopped.
We've been speaking with Mara Verheyden-Hilliard of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund. Find them online at justiceonline.org. Mara Verheyden-Hilliard, thank you very much for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
This is Alex Smith, and I'm telling you, the world media is asleep, drugged into Trump and Trump investigations, lost in meaningless entertainment babble, while endlessly selling you very dangerous products. Here is the real story. Humans have already driven Earth's climate into a new state. The atmosphere has filled with greenhouse gases, acting like a blanket, with heating that can no longer be stopped. The melting poles are just the beginning. If you are a regular Radio EcoShock listener, you probably know that already from the many scientists, hundreds now, that I've interviewed for you. Maybe it's hard to be surprised, but I'm shocked by countless signs that we are already entering the extreme danger zone. Let me give you just one example. Record high temperatures, lasting longer than usual, are slamming the Northern Hemisphere. I've already talked to you about high temperatures in Pakistan and India and Vietnam, but this is a little closer to home for many of you. Yes, it's the start of summer. Summers are hot. But in the 27 years of monitoring climate news that I've done, I've never seen a collection of heat reports as came in this past week. In the United Kingdom, that place surrounded by cooling oceans, temperatures of 91.5 degrees, melted roads there, that's hot for the UK. Health officials warned young kids who have less bodily heat control than adults, and seniors who die in great numbers during extreme heat events. They warned them to take shelter. And then it got hotter. In London, ambulance calls went up 46% as temperatures there reached 35.4 degrees C, or almost 96 degrees. Most people in the UK do not expect such heat and do not have air conditioning. The science blog phys.org writes about the heat wave all over Europe from London to Siberia. There have been heat deaths already in California and New Mexico. You know some flights out of Phoenix, Arizona were canceled because the heat was too hot for some planes to fly. There were three record hot days in Phoenix, reaching 117 degrees Fahrenheit on June 20th, which is over 47 degrees C. The overnight low, and this is key for human survival, was over 90 degrees Fahrenheit, or 32 degrees C. That's relentless heat. Blogger Robert Scribler has a great summary under the title, World Climate Stays in Uncharted Territory as May of 2017 Hits Second Hottest on Record. In perfect timing, our Radio EcoShock guest recently, Camilo Mora of the University of Hawaii, with 17 other scientists from several countries, published a new study in the journal Nature Climate Change. The title is Global Risk of Deadly Heat. And Camilo says, I can't understand why people aren't more worried about this. I mean, America's going to turn into abysmal heat. Seth Borenstein, the reliable reporter from Associated Press, gives it this headline, Too Hot to Handle. Study shows Earth's killer heat worsens. The study says 20% of humans already experience 20 days a year of deadly heat. By the end of this century, unless dramatic action intervenes, 3 out of 4 humans will live or die through that kind of heat. It's planetary heating. Let's call it, global warming. I'm calling it. The heat is here. We may have some cooler years, some crazy cold snaps to bring the deniers out of their cozy homes and offices. But from this time on out, we'll get more and more heat waves, lasting longer, with hotter nights, less ice, and less chance to save ourselves from outright climate catastrophe. Did the Russians interfere with the American elections? Our first guest this week will explain how monumental and lethal all human intervention in the climate has been. Clive Hamilton talks about his new book, Defiant Earth. Then we'll go to what you might call a lesser story. The nuclear industry and their captured regulators in America have decided it's not worth a few million dollars to prevent the evacuation and possible permanent evacuation of places like New York, Baltimore, where millions and millions of Americans live. That's a story repeated wherever there is a nuclear power plant near a big population center. And it's not just the known and demonstrated risk in Russia, in, Japan, of a nuclear reactor meltdown. No, it's the vast collections of nuclear fuel accumulating in poorly protected pools. And this isn't news to terrorists. They already know. They've already been thinking about it. The legendary Frank von Hippel from Princeton tells you the awful truth.
Radio EcoShock.
We've just had major, major heat waves in most parts of the Northern Hemisphere. It's not just the Middle East and Pakistan where you might expect it. It's New York, London, Paris, and Los Angeles sweltering under road-melting temperatures. But that's just the 30-second weather report, isn't it? The rest of the news goes on as though we haven't changed the climate or gone off course. 3 years ago, I talked with Clive Hamilton about his book, Earth Masters, The Humans Who Want to Control the Climate with Geoengineering. Now this leading Australian intellectual is back with even worse news. The future is stranger than anyone thinks. He's captured all that in a new book titled Defiant Earth, The Fate of Humans in the Anthropocene. That's your fate in the new time. Dr. Hamilton has lectured at Yale, Oxford, and Cambridge. He's been the executive director of the Australia Institute and longtime professor of public ethics at Charles Sturt University in Canberra, Australia. From Canberra, Clive, a warm welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
It's good to be back, Alex.
What do you make of the extreme weather that has arrived way sooner than many scientists predicted? Are we in a climate shift already?
I think there's no doubt about that. The climate system of the Earth is now starting to function in a different way. As one climate scientist put it, the old rules that govern the Earth's dynamics are now changing, and we're having trouble anticipating what's going to come. But we do know for sure that it's going to get hotter. The climate system is more energetic, and that will bring more extreme events like cyclones, heat waves, droughts, and so on.
In the United States, and to some degree in your own Australia, people trying to survive ungodly heat or flooded out by unheard-of dumps of rain, they still manage to vote for climate deniers. How is that possible?
It's an astonishing insight into the delusory capacities of the human psyche. After all, the best scientists in the world have been warning us for some 25 years now that we're headed into dark times, hot times, and yet somehow most people find a way to, if not outright deny what the climate scientists are saying, to nevertheless downplay it, avoid it, evade it, put it in another box, pretend that, well, maybe they're exaggerating, or some technology will come along, and after all, aren't there other scientists saying that it's all exaggerated? So we grasp at straws, don't we? And, you know, we need to be in a way, I've become kind of more forgiving because, you know, well-meaning, reasonably well-informed people I know, yes, they accept the science. Yes, they think we need to do something about climate change, but really it's way down their list of priorities. But if you listen to what the scientists are telling us, what could be a higher priority than protecting the livability of planet Earth?
I have to admit, I had a hard time reading your book, Defiant Earth. And, you know, I mean, there's no throwaway pages here. There's no throwaway sentences. It's really packed. And some sentence would send me past, oh, God, that's true, into a temporary brain melt. I have to go away and think about it. It's just not easy to understand where we are, is it?
I wrote this book because climate scientists, or rather Earth system scientists, there's quite a lot of overlap there, but Earth system scientists are telling us something kind of bigger and more confronting than the science of climate change. They've recently started to tell us that the Earth system, that is the totality of the Earth from its core out through the atmosphere to the moon, has entered into a new geological epoch, the Anthropocene, the age of humans. So just stop and think about that. What they're saying is that human impact on nature has now become so large and powerful that we rival the great forces of nature on the functioning of the Earth system as a whole. Wow, we have become a geological force. And that to a significant degree, the future evolution of the planet, and we're talking hundreds of thousands of years here, is now in our hands. We've knocked it off its course and there's no going back. But in the next decades, we will decide collectively, or at least the powers that be will decide, under the influence in democratic countries of the citizenry, whether we knock it much further off course and send the Earth spinning into an extremely chaotic, dangerous, and potentially existential phase of its development. So we have now entered into deep time. That is, the 4.5 billion year history of the Earth is divided up into a whole range of epochs and eras and ages and so on, the Jurassic, the Cretaceous, and so on. What the scientists are now telling us is that we have entered into a new epoch, the Anthropocene, determined by human impact. And this has happened only in the last decades. This is a very, very profound thing that's very hard to get your head around. In fact, I think it will take us years to really understand what the meaning of this new epoch is.
Yeah, I read you saying that the whole 9 billion years time that this planet is expected to live has been split into halves before humans and after humans, and I had an internal objection. I mean, it makes us sound like the new gods on the block. Isn't that overreaching a bit?
Well, what do gods do? Among many other things, and we're kind of speaking literally if that's your way of thinking, or metaphorically if you're not religiously inclined. I mean, powerful gods determine the future of the Earth, the shape of the Earth, how it changes, how it evolves. And what the Earth system scientists are telling us is that's what we're now doing. So it seems to me that we really have to face up to this kind of astonishing fact. Much as we may hate it and find it difficult to swallow, the truth is that humans have become powerful beyond any previous imagining. We are now powerful enough to change the geological future of the Earth. So the question that screams out at us is this: how can we own up to the truth of this extraordinary power and take ownership of it without succumbing to the narcissism and the Promethean delusions of grandeur that got us into this impossible situation in the first place? To me, this is the fundamental question. How do we own up to the truth of what the Earth system scientists are telling us about our astonishing technological power, and yet not continue to abuse it and send the Earth off into such a disastrous place that many forms of life can't survive?
Well, I guess the good news and the bad news is we may have delayed the next ice age.
This is one of those facts that I like to use because it illustrates this point so powerfully. Geologists can now predict with a pretty good degree of accuracy when the next ice age will come. And ice ages are determined, and indeed warming periods, by how much solar radiation reaches the Earth. And the Earth has a number of cycles. It wobbles around its axis. The axis changes its tilt. You know, we're talking over periods of thousands of years. And the orbit of the Earth around the Sun varies from pretty much circular to somewhat elliptical. And all of these affect the amount of solar radiation heating the planet. And on this basis, they can calculate that the next ice age is due in around about 50,000 years' time. But the confronting fact is that they're also telling us that because of warming that human beings have brought about on the Earth, much of which is now locked in, and more warming, which will inevitably occur, will definitely go beyond 2 degrees, probably 3 to 4. That amount of warming, which will last such a long time, will actually suppress the next ice age in 50,000 years' time. And if we don't do a lot more in the next 2-3 decades, it may well suppress the subsequent ice age, which is due in 130,000 years' time. So these facts tell us just how enduring the human impact on the planet is. And, you know, some people might say, well, hey, who wants another ice age? I don't like the sound of that. Well, I say, rather than warm the planet in an intolerable way for 50,000 years, how about you come back in to me in 49,000 years' time and say, hey, we're expecting an ice age in about, you know, several centuries. Let's start thinking about what we might do.
Good plan. You know, I've got a bit of confusion. What is the difference between the Great Acceleration and the Anthropocene, or is there a difference?
Yes, there is. The Great Acceleration is the term used by Earth system scientists like Will Steffen and Jan Zalasiewicz to describe the really extraordinary takeoff after the end of the Second World War. So from kind of the late 40s, early 50s, 1950s, in global resource use, population growth, waste generation, CO2, methane, nitrous oxide, resource use, land use, fossil fuel consumption, mineral use, and so on. If you look at a whole range of those over a long period of time, you see that after the end of the Second World War, they suddenly took off and accelerated. And so they call that the Great Acceleration. And they've decided, the Earth system scientists now, many of the leading ones now meeting in what's known as the Anthropocene Working Group, which is the official body tasked with gathering the evidence to make the case for a new geological epoch called the Anthropocene. Those scientists say, in our best judgment, the new epoch, the Anthropocene, started after the Second World War as a result of the Great Acceleration.
And you write, they prognosticate about a future from which the dominant facts have been expunged, futurologists trapped in an obsolete past. It is the great silence. Who are you talking about?
Well, if you walk into a bookshop, a good bookshop, you'll go to sections which are about the future of the world, our futurologists, our kind of great thinkers who are prognosticating about what the 21st century will look like. One name that comes to mind, Steven Pinker, for instance, but there are plenty of others. You can see them all over the place. And if you open them up and look at the table of contents or go to the index, you'll find no mention or virtually no mention of climate change whatever. And so it's as if they live in another world, one where the science of climate change, let alone the Anthropocene, doesn't exist. It's as though, well, you know, we'll leave the science to the scientists, but, you know, it's not really within our intellectual universe. So we'll talk about, you know, the clash of civilizations and future technological singularities and this kind of thing, as if the scientists don't exist. I mean, these are, you know, the greatest intellectuals in the world, and yet they are in denial. I just find this astonishing. I think our intellectuals are really failing us very badly indeed, because if the great and good at Harvard and Princeton and Cambridge are not deeply engaged with climate change and the kind of earth, the kind of world, the kind of international community that is likely to create, then they don't understand what the future is.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. My guest is the well-known Australian academic, Dr. Clive Hamilton. Clive wrote or co-authored books like Growth Fetish, Affluenza, and Requiem for a Species. We're talking about his latest, Defiant Earth, The Fate of Humans in the Anthropocene. Now, your previous book, Earth Masters, exposed the dubious ideas behind trying to fix the damage from technology with more technology. But I gather the whole concept of geoengineering is getting outmoded, being based on some sort of classical Earth and not the new Earth systems we've created. Is that what you're saying?
In my earlier book, Earth Masters, I made the point that under the impact of human-induced climate change, the Earth system is moving into a new phase, as some of the Earth system scientists have described it. We are entering into a no-analog state. In other words, nothing like this has happened before. The Earth is becoming, the climate system is becoming more energetic, as they put it, more energy in the system. And that means that it's becoming more chaotic in its behavior, more unpredictable, and of course, more uncontrollable. And climate scientists and Earth system scientists use metaphors to try to communicate to us what this means. James Lovelock, for example, famously talks about the revenge of Gaia. And we have Earth system scientists talking about the waking giant and Arctic death spirals to try to communicate to us that the Earth is no longer the passive, submissive, entity that we thought it was, whether we were either on the Promethean side, well, there it is, we'll go and exploit it and rip what we want out of it, and we'll, that's what our right, and you know, who's going to object, or even the environmentalists, you know, my tribe, if you like, who have traditionally regarded the Earth as kind of Mother Earth, passive, submissive, whom we're raping and pillaging. No, Earth is no longer like that. That was the Earth perhaps in the Holocene before we entered into the Anthropocene. But in the Anthropocene, the Earth is an angry beast. And to the idea that we should use our technology, having poked and prodded and provoked this beast into waking up, which is now raging around, that we can now use our technology to try to pacify it, to drug it, to quiet it down, I think is an extremely dangerous approach. And we have enormous power, and we can't repudiate that. What we have to do is to learn to use it meekly, if you like, humbly, responsibly, without running away from it.
And I also have the concern that planners, including some top scientists and almost every politician, assume that our economy will continue despite hit after hit from a destabilized atmosphere, the rising seas and all that. It's like the Stern Report. Here's a 5% cost for addressing climate change or something. What do you think? Can we just keep the economy rolling along despite all this that's happening?
Well, there are kind of two possibly contradictory answers here. One is, the economists have argued that the sensible ones, not the apologists for the fossil fuel industries, that the technologies to replace fossil fuel-based energy are there, available, and not only will they be cheaper, in many places they already are. Here in Australia, for example, it's universally agreed, except perhaps by the coal industry, and even they now have trouble defending their view. It's universally agreed that building solar plants and wind farms will generate cheaper electricity than building new coal-fired power plants. On the other hand, when we look at how the Earth is starting to change in response to warming, and bear in mind the Earth is on average warmer by 1.1 degree, although much more in the Arctic, and I'm completely freaked out about what's happening in the Arctic, and we will definitely warm by twice as much as 1.1 degrees. Look how much trouble we're in now, how much more we're going to get. So how can an economy, the current system, given that it's produced this unfolding disaster, how can it survive? How can it cope? There are people out there, environmentalists, conservative environmentalists, who call themselves eco-modernists, and they're particularly gathered around a think tank known as the Breakthrough Institute in San Francisco. They argue that there's no problem with the system. Our technology-based, profit-oriented capitalist system may have produced a bit of a problem, but hey, it's endlessly inventive, creative, and can tackle any problem, and it will tackle this. So what we need is more technology, more capitalism. And I think this is an extremely dangerous argument. And perhaps there are some people in some countries starting to wake up to this. I mean, look at the kind of support that Bernie Sanders got, who declared himself to be a socialist in the United States. And then Jeremy Corbyn in the UK, who adopted a very progressive social democratic agenda. And so now we have a kind of, we're on the cusp of the turning of the neoliberal revolution, which ought to empower brave politicians to challenge some of the fundamentals of the neoliberal capitalist order.
So, how are climate politics going in Australia these days?
Oh, Alex, do you want the long and depressing answer or the short and depressing answer? We now have a Prime Minister who of our Conservative Party, which oddly is known as the Liberal Party, Malcolm Turnbull, who once said that I will never lead a Liberal Party that doesn't share the same commitment to climate change as I do. And he was seen as the kind of great white hope of conservative politics among those who take climate science seriously. But when he was elevated to the prime ministership, replacing an out-and-out climate science denier in the form of Tony Abbott, suddenly Turnbull found that the forces of darkness, of denial of the fossil fuel industry, the fearful men and women who can't tolerate change, who loathe environmentalism, they got their claws into him. And we saw this man, Malcolm Turnbull, so committed to doing something on climate change, become gradually hollowed out, become the captive of the troglodytes, so that a few months ago he started to argue what we need in Australia is a new generation of coal-fired power plants.
Oh, that sounds so familiar. You know, we'll bring back those coal mining jobs, as Trump says. You know, I was kind of caught in that regard by your later quote in the book from Napoleon saying, politics is fate. What does that mean?
Well, I love this quote. You can read a lot of meanings into it. The kind of meaning I was putting into it in the book is this idea that although there's something happening in the Anthropocene at the grand level of humankind and the Earth, of deep history and dramatic change, if we're going to think about what to do, the answer is always political. The only answer is politics, and our fate, therefore, and indeed the fate of the Earth, lies in the hands of political action. And while we're on the question of fate, which I put into the subtitle of the book, The Fate of Humans in the Anthropocene, I was very struck by a sentence in a scientific article, a number of Earth system scientists who are talking about the impact of humankind on the geological evolution of the Earth, and of course the way in which the changing functioning of the Earth system under the impacts of climate change, but also other system-wide environmental change. They said of humans and of the Earth, the fate of one determines the fate of the other. And I thought, wow, I mean, that is just so powerful if you start thinking about it over this kind of stretch of big time and big history. But in the end, whatever change comes about as a result of human life on Earth, it will come about not through individual action, not by, you know, conscious consumerism, not by sitting back and hoping that some brilliant mind will invent a new technology that will come along and save us. It will be through politics that the Earth will evolve.
I'm personally not so sure about that. I think that some individual actions and societies changing away almost from the political system, unseen perhaps, you know, as more people grow their own food, go local, do all these small-scale changes that aren't as visible on the federal level. But you also say, and you talked about this earlier, that our choices are either to go for more control, call it geoengineering or climate engineering or whatever, or, and this is a tough one, to practice meekness. I'm wondering if practice meekness might need to be your next book. What does it mean?
Well, let me point out one thing it doesn't mean. It does not mean that we can kind of withdraw from the world, repudiate technology, and, you know, in the old enviro phrase, walk more lightly on the earth. I mean, I think, of course, we do have to walk more lightly on the earth. But the fundamental point about the Anthropocene is that we can't walk away from it. We have shifted the functioning of the earth system in a way that is now irreversible. Because the Earth has now, the rules have changed. We have changed the rules of the way the Earth functions in ways that some ways we do understand. It's getting hotter. We're going to have more extreme weather events, but also in ways that are very hard to predict. So we can't turn back the geological clock from the Anthropocene, which we've now entered, into the previous kind of golden era of the Holocene, where for 10,000 years, the Earth went into this extraordinarily and unusual period of stability and clemency of the weather, so stable and clement that it allowed civilization to develop. Now we've changed all of that, and we can't just say, oops, stop, 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 we'll go back to the Holocene, because we've set the Earth on a different path. What we have to now do is to manage that, to cope with it, to deal with it. I hope that we do it, that we approach that task with an attitude of meekness, of humility, but not without repudiating the incredible power that we have. You see what I mean? How do we take responsibility for this power? Do we do it with great humility and care, or do we do it with a kind of Promethean aggression, a kind of Donald Trump, you know, we can crash through and use our power to subdue the earth? If we try that, we are screwed, and many life forms are screwed. So that's what I'm saying. We have to try this seemingly impossible task of owning up to our power, not running away from it, but using it in a way that minimizes the damage and adapts in a way over the next centuries in a way that is as just and fair and reasonable and respectful of life as we possibly can.
As we wrap up here, Clive Hamilton, is there anything else you would like to talk about with our listeners?
Let me just say one thing, Alex. It's been a kind of fascinating project writing this book, and I've kept just kind of shifting my views of I've understood more, maybe understood less, some readers might think. But some readers, I'm not a Christian or a person with any particular religious orientation, but I know that one or two people who are theologians who read the book in draft saw in it some very powerful theological themes. And I can see what they mean, because it really is about the place of humans on this earth. It is about human fate and how the gods, if I can put it that way, might be looking down on this powerful, errant, but special creature on the earth, and our mistakes, and how they should regard us, whether we deserve saving, whether there is some kind of hope that we can invest some faith in. These kinds of questions come up right through the book, so that people who do have a theological orientation found themselves stopping and thinking about it in the way they think about human beings and our existence on earth. So I found that extremely interesting. So it definitely has a kind of theological resonance for people who are attuned that way.
Well, Clive, I have to admit, I haven't quite finished your book, and it's your fault because you keep sending me away to think. You know, I hope it turns out well.
Thanks, Alex.
I'll put links to today's discussion in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org and also my previous interview with Clive in May 2013. By all means, get Clive's tweets at Clive C. Hamilton and visit his website at clivehamilton.com. His latest brain-bending book is Defiant Earth, The Fate of Humans in the Anthropocene. Clive, thank you so much for joining us again on Radio EcoShock. I always enjoy talking with you.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Americans are not protected from a catastrophic nuclear waste fire at many reactor sites. The fallout from radioactive fuel could be huge, much larger than from the 2011 Fukushima reactor accident in Japan. Millions of people would be exposed to radioactive particles. There could be forced mass and possibly permanent evacuations of major U.S. cities. Taxpayers could be forced to pay trillions for damages and decontamination efforts. That's all in a new article published in the May 26th issue of Science magazine. The report comes from researchers at Princeton University and the Union of Concerned Scientists. Our guest, Frank von Hippel, is a co-author of this warning. He's a senior research physicist at Princeton's Program on Science and Global Security. That is based at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. Dr. von Hippel is the author of several books. He has advised governments in the past. He has a thorough background in the physics of atomic affairs. Dr. von Hippel, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
Was there a fire in the fuel pools during the 2011 nuclear accident at Fukushima, Japan?
There was not. The water level fell in the pool of unit number 4, but it didn't uncover the spent fuel, and therefore we didn't have the scenario in which radioactive heat in the fuel would have heated it up to a temperature where the metal cladding, the zirconium cladding on the fuel, would have caught fire.
It was so hard to get reliable information about what happened at Fukushima, especially at Reactor 4, where the building was unstable, and Reactor 3, which was burning and storing plutonium-laced fuel. I guess the Japanese government was trying to control public fear, and U.S. regulators weren't saying much either. Frank, I'm concerned if an accident happens in the States, the public won't get good and timely information for the same reasons. What do you think?
Well, actually, in the case of the Fukushima, the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission was convinced that there was a fire going in pool number 4 for about a week or two after the earthquake, and so their information wasn't very good either. I think they don't cover up. I mean, in Japan, there is a history of cover-ups, but not so much in the U.S. The problem really is the confusion. I go back far enough. I remember Three Mile Island when there was a huge fear that there was going to be an explosion in the reactor. It turned out to be an unfounded fear. But there is a lot of confusion at a time of a nuclear accident.
Well, that's partly because you can't really get to the site. It's too dangerous to go there, and so you can fly over maybe, and even that's dangerous.
That's right. In fact, the hint that we got that maybe there was water in pool number 4 after all was a reflection that somebody in a helicopter thought they saw through a hole that had been blown in the building by a hydrogen explosion.
Now, following the Fukushima accident, and particularly the problems with spent fuel, the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission promised to take action to avoid similar risks in America. What action has been taken that you know of?
Well, there was a whole list of possible actions that they considered, and some they took, like having available emergency equipment, pumping equipment, in case the power went out on the regular equipment in the reactor as it did in Fukushima. But the action that they considered but decided not to take, and we were complaining about in our article, was to end the dense pack, what we call the dense packing of fuel in U.S. reactor pools.
Well, I want to talk to you more about that in a minute, but first I want to point out that the public thinks this is all taken care of, just like people in Japan thought their experts were completely in control of nuclear technology. American authorities, nuclear operators have known about this big risk from nuclear fuel pools for decades. Frank, why are you raising it again now?
Well, it's because, it's a good question why now, because, you know, the politics right now in the United States aren't very favorable to new regulatory initiatives. You know, there's an administration in that wants to reduce the amount of regulation. And in fact, just today they had hearings on nominations for 3 out of the 5 members of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And they're all of skeptics of concerning regulations. They want to have a light touch. And so our proposal, which would cost $50 million per reactor, is something that the industry doesn't like, and the industry has a lot of sway over the regulators in the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission right now.
Well, I have to tell you, in previous interviews, experts from the Union of Concerned Scientists told me the NRC has a long history of waiting years to make safety regulations, and then they give nuclear reactor operators a lot more years to implement those changes. So I'm not surprised by what you're saying, but I want to get specific about what this $50 million a reactor could avoid. In the article in Science Magazine, there's a graphic map showing possible areas covered by the radioactive plume if a spent fuel fire happened at the Peach Bottom nuclear power plant. That's in Pennsylvania. If the fire happens in January, it looks like Philadelphia becomes red hot and New York City gets a dose that could be survivable. The same accident in April is a massive disaster, spreading hot contamination up and down the East Coast. But a fall fire takes the danger west towards Virginia, Kentucky, and even Ohio. Frank, why such a big difference in the seasons of when an accident happens?
I'm not sure it's the seasons. What we did was we did 12 calculations for a release starting on the first day of each month. And so there is a lot of variation in weather, wind direction, and so on. And And it's not necessarily a question of season. It can depend on whether there's rain or not, bringing down the radioactivity that's in the atmosphere. That area of contamination to the northeast of the Fukushima plant was brought down by rain, actually.
Well, I've heard that the Japanese just got lucky and that the prevailing winds took the radioactivity, about 9/10 of it, right out into the Pacific instead of right over Japan.
That's right. It's on the east coast, and the prevailing winds are offshore.
Well, it's like a nuclear casino there. Now, is there a chance that a major city like New York, Baltimore, or even Washington, D.C., would have to be evacuated entirely if there was a spent fuel fire at just one reactor somewhere in the east?
There is a chance, and we calculated that, after correcting some NRC calculations, that on average, 8 million people would have to be relocated. It could go up. It could be much higher than that. That's just an average number. And what we're concerned is not the radiation levels killing people outright, but increasing their risk of cancer to an unacceptable level. And the EPA has set a threshold for the annual dose that in their view would justify relocation, and that our maps are based on that dose.
Would some areas or possibly even a city have to remain abandoned, like the land around Chernobyl, or could the radioactivity eventually be cleaned up, as they're trying to do in Fukushima City?
Yeah, the luck with cleaning up hasn't been so great. You know, in Fukushima, the best they've been able to do is to reduce the radiation level by a factor of three. So in areas marginally contaminated, you could do that. I think, of course, you'd put Fukushima, the contamination is mostly, we're not talking about big cities. We're talking about towns and really a lot of open land. And so there would be a much more major effort, intense effort, if, for example, we're talking about a city like Washington or New York. But I think some painful decisions would have to be made, about whether maybe rather than abandon all that high cost buildings, whether people would decide that they would be willing to tolerate a somewhat higher cancer risk.
More people would die sooner is what it boils down to. I know that California ratepayers had to pay an additional levy to decommission nuclear power plants at the end of their operation period. But who pays for the damages if a nuclear fuel storage facility catches fire?
Well, the industry is required to have a collective insurance pool. And at the moment, that totals $13.6 billion. But if you're talking about $2 trillion, like, which is our estimate of the average cost of a spent fuel fire in a dense packed pool, then basically the 99% of the cost would be on the taxpayers. Or on the people, on the people who have to abandon their property.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is physicist Frank von Hippel from Princeton. We're talking about the unimaginable risk if a fire erupts at a nuclear fuel storage facility at any reactor, as detailed in a new article in Science magazine. The Mark I GE design reactors have the dangerous situation of storing some nuclear fuel in the reactor building, essentially above the reactor itself. The four blown reactors in Fukushima all had that design, as you know. Some of the reactors of the same type are still operating in the U.S. I think it's around 20 or so, despite those known flaws. Have the American Mark I reactors been made any safer to avoid the same issues as happened in Japan?
They haven't, really. In Japan, they are. I mean, there are other issues besides the elevated spent fuel pool. It turns out that other reactors, even when they have their pools at ground level, many of them can partially drain. There's cavities below them, or maybe a wall is exposed above grade. So, but there are other issues with the GE Mark I, II reactors that you're talking about, and one of them, which we saw in Fukushima, was that the volumes of the containments around the reactors are much smaller than typical for other types of reactors. And that issue is an issue that a colleague and I and other people have raised in the 70s after Three Mile Island. And we suggested that if you get into a situation, which actually happened at Fukushima, where that containment gets overpressured, that there be a system where you can release the pressure through a filter system so that the radioactivity is mostly kept inside the building. Most countries, actually, in most of Europe, basically Western Europe, adopted that recommendation. The U.S. and Japan didn't. Now Japan is doing that. That's another lesson from Fukushima that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission looked at. It estimated it would cost the utilities $15 million, and they decided not to ask them to spend that money.
Now, if the fuel rods that you mentioned are all jammed into pools beyond their original design intention, does that make a nuclear fire more likely or worse if it happens?
It makes not necessarily more likely, but definitely worse. And first of all, there's more fuel to burn. But something else which the NRC has actually found, we hadn't thought of it, was it makes a hydrogen explosion more likely. What happens in the early stages of the uncovery is that steam reacts with a hot metal cladding. And the H2O, the O basically goes in and makes an oxide with the metal cladding, and the H2 then becomes free hydrogen. And in the case of a dense-packed pool, the NRC staff found that enough hydrogen would be developed so you would have an explosion that would blow the building open, which is actually what happened at Fukushima, although the hydrogen in that case was from the reactor's cores. And if you have a building blown away, then if there is a fire, all the radioactivity gets released into the open air. Whereas if you don't have a hydrogen explosion, which is what the NRC staff concluded that you would not have if you followed the recommendation that they rejected, the building would remain intact and most of the radioactivity would plate out on the inside of the building.
Well, I think it's always a good idea to avoid an explosion at a nuclear storage site. I'll go with you that far. Now, there is a safer option, I think, that I've heard about, which is the dry cask storage. Do you think that's safer?
Yes, and in fact, that's what we recommend, and that's what the NRC considered. Basically, after a few years, the NRC was considering 5 years. After 5 years of cooling in water, you can remove the fuel and put it in air-cooled casks. And that was the original plan design of the pools was that they were only going to have fuel in there for a few years and then it was going to be removed. But when what they were going to do with this fuel off-site, that plan was canceled. Then the utilities put more and more fuel into the pools until they're packed about as densely as the reactor cores. That means that they could go critical, and therefore they have to put each fuel assembly inside a box with neutron-absorbing walls. And that's what makes it a dense-packed fuel, if the water level drops and uncovers it, so difficult to cool in one of these accident situations.
How long can those fuel pools be maintained safely if the electric grid goes down for any reason?
Well, it's a slowly developing accident, and what was remarkable about Fukushima was for how long, you know, the situation was out of control. It was for about a month at the site. It takes on that order of length of time for the water to boil down if it's not replenished, for the spent fuel to become uncovered. The other scenario, which the NRC thought that was incredible that could happen here, and they didn't even consider such a scenario where things would be out of control for so long. So they considered scenarios where an earthquake would cause the pool to crack and drain, which would be, and they considered scenarios in which within a day or so the fuel would be uncovered.
Hmm. Are the American dry cask designs prepared for a terrorist attack, and are they as good as the German design?
Well, there are a variety of designs, and the German design, I think, that you're thinking about is a very thick-walled cast iron cask, whereas the American design is a thin-walled steel canister and then surrounded by a radiation shield of reinforced concrete. I prefer the German design myself, but I think either is much safer than leaving the fuel in the pool in a dense pack configuration.
So why doesn't the NRC mandate the transfer to dry casks be done right now?
Well, because they calculated it would cost $50 million, and they figured the probability, and so they did a cost-benefit analysis. And the cost-benefit analysis was first to estimate the consequences, and then multiply by the probability, and then compare that with the cost. And they took an arbitrary probability, which included not taking into account the possibility of a terrorist attack, and they underestimated the consequences. And on that basis, they concluded that the benefit in terms of the probability multiplied times the consequences would be less than the $50 million per pool that it would cost the utilities to move early to fuel to earlier than they have to fuel to dry cask storage.
Well, you mentioned terrorism. I know reactor buildings are supposed to be hardened to withstand an attack by crash landing an aircraft. It's my understanding that spent fuel ponds, however, which contain far more radioactive material, are not hardened in that way. True?
The pools themselves are quite robust, but the building above them is a very lightweight building, so that there would certainly be nothing to prevent an aircraft from crashing into a pool.
And is there any possibility the computer systems which operate and monitor those spent fuel tanks could be hacked as cyber warfare or in a terrorist attack?
There could be. It's less of a concern than what the consequences would be for a reactor, because the timescale for a reactor is going without cooling is a matter of minutes before you get into trouble with a meltdown, whereas for a pool, it's really a matter of days. So hacking is less of a concern for the pool.
Okay. Now, if a terrorist attack struck an on-site nuclear fuel, would it be the same thing as a fuel fire for any other reason, like an accident, or might an explosion spread radioactivity further?
I think the concern, fire in a drained pool is sort of like a worst case already.
Mm-hmm.
And so terrorists, the concern about terrorists is that they might be able to cause that, or, you know, the NRC didn't consider that, but they considered the possibility of an earthquake causing that. But it would be a similar event, however it was caused.
Dr. von Hippel, what do you think of the temporary nuclear fuel parking lot proposed for West Texas?
Well, this is a proposal to transport fuel in casks down and basically park them one scenario would be just on a concrete pad in that area. I don't see, for spent fuel at an operating nuclear power plant, I don't see the point, because you can do that equally well at the reactor site. But we have an increasing number of reactors which are being shut down, and then after a while, all you have is spent fuel and dry casks, and there is a point to consolidating that in one place so you can have an adequate security.
Who else helped you write this report?
Well, I had a colleague at Union Concerned Scientists, a physicist who spent his career sort of trying to understand the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and trying to get it to do its job better. And then another colleague at Princeton who had state-of-the-art capabilities of modeling this atmospheric dispersion and deposition, which actually capabilities that the NRC is trying to acquire but has not yet acquired, so that he made it possible for us to have these historical simulations with historical weather, what would have happened had there been a spent fuel fire starting in a particular place on a particular day.
Well, I'm shocked but not surprised that the new administration will appoint people who don't like regulations to the NRC. But if you were called to advise the President or Congress, what priority recommendations would you and your colleagues make?
In this current case, I understand their reluctance to ask the nuclear utilities to make additional expenditures at a time when a number of these nuclear power plants can't compete with wind and natural gas. And therefore, we recommended that actually, if Congress is actually already paying for these dry casks, when the spent fuel is transferred, when the pools are absolutely jam-packed and you can't put any more, and you need to put more in because the reactor's discharging it, you take out the oldest 25-year-old spent fuel and put it into dry cask. We're already paying for that. And so I would recommend that we actually pay for doing that earlier and get out of this situation. The other recommendation we make is that in some states, so far, New York, and are actually subsidizing uneconomic nuclear power plants to keep them open. And a minor part of that subsidy would be sufficient to pay for this earlier, what the NRC calls expedited transfer of spent fuel from pools to dry casks. And so the states could require that. They don't have any authority to impose safety regulations on nuclear power plants, but if they're giving money, then that gives them leverage to make a quid pro quo.
Well, as we wrap up, Frank, you are from a famous family of scientists and educators. You've written books for the public about nuclear risks. You were an assistant director for national security in the Clinton White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. You've been at this for at least 5 decades. Does it frustrate you that humans just can't seem to rise up to the responsibility of having and using nuclear technology?
It is frustrating. You know, I've spent most of my time worrying about nuclear weapons, where the risk is even greater. We do make progress now and then, and I just hope the question is whether we're making fast enough progress, and we'll only know. With time, whether in fact we've taken actions in time that we really should to make this a safer world.
We'll know if we survive it.
Right.
We've been talking with Dr. Frank von Hippel. He's a nuclear expert, policy advisor, author, and a senior research physicist at Princeton Program on Science and Global Security. You can find links to follow up in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Frank, thank you so much for spending time with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
The American coal industry is dying, thank goodness. Even as coal baron Robert Murray sues TV host John Oliver for telling him so. Trump promises to bring back coal, but he can't. But elsewhere, in Australia, Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull has reversed himself on global warming and now calls, incredibly, for new coal-burning power plants. I guess he missed the fires and the heat waves and the droughts and the floods. India is counting on coal power for its billion people. China continues to burn mountains of coal every day. Even green-talking Germany continues to burn coal. It's like nobody heard the science, the news, or the weather reports. It's like humans do not believe their own sweating bodies. The atmosphere and the seas are the new invaders. As Clive Hamilton says, this is the dawn of the defiant Earth. Maybe we can't stop this now, but can we at least sound the alarm and head for the lifeboats instead of going down with the ship? That will be my new mission when I return with new Radio EcoShock shows this coming September. In the meantime, I'm going to comb through my 11 years of interviews to bring you the fundamentals and the cutting edges you might have missed. Please tune in again next week. Thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock, and thank you for caring about the future.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
It does show a severe disconnect between the MLA and the academic community that it is supposedly representing.
There is a hunger out there, not only among NAP members, but also among Canadians, to have an honest conversation on Israel and Palestine, and to actually champion human rights, to champion principled leadership.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Oakland, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. In the second half of our podcast today, you'll hear from a Palestinian-Canadian organizer working with others to push the new Democratic Party to adopt a more progressive policy on Palestine. But first, members of the Modern Language Association, the largest academic association for scholars of language and literature, voted in June to, quote, refrain from endorsing the boycott of Israeli academic institutions, dealing a blow to scholars who have for years been organizing within the MLA to support the call from Palestinian students and academics to boycott Israeli academic institutions until Israel stops violating Palestinian rights. MLA Members for Justice in Palestine, a group at the forefront of organizing in support of the academic boycott within the MLA, wrote recently that, quote, after a series of successes, this result represents an unfortunate but not dispiriting setback for the academic boycott movement within the MLA. Setbacks are not uncommon for Palestinians or anyone committed to advocating Palestinian rights. Palestinians have suffered an almost endless series of defeats at the hands of the Israeli military, but affirm their right to exist in Palestine, forging a remarkable culture of resistance that stands in opposition to Israel's ruthless colonialism. Joining us to talk about the MLA vote and the next steps for supporting the academic boycott are two professors and members of the Modern Language Association, Salah Hassan of Michigan State University and Rebecca Comey of the University of Toronto. Thank you both for being with us today on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thanks for having us.
So, Salah, let's start off with you. The MLA has now officially adopted a stance that is hostile to academic boycotts of Israel. Can you briefly talk about what led up to this vote? This was, of course, after a debacle in January around a resolution in favor of the boycott, which was denigrated by Israel advocates within the organization and by outside lobby groups. Talk about the timeline here.
Okay, well, I think we have to step back a little bit. About 3 years ago, Rebecca Comey and David Lloyd took the initiative to draft a resolution calling on the association to endorse the academic boycott of Israel. And in response to, in part in response to, but also perhaps also trying to preempt further initiatives, Russell Berman led a counter-initiative to put forward the resolution that ultimately was ratified by the membership, Resolution 2017.
And who is Russell Berman?
Russell Berman is a professor of German at Stanford University, and he is a former president of the MLA. And he along with Carrie Nelson, who was very much in the forefront, and a handful of other MLA members, had in previous years been accusing MLA members of putting forward boycott resolutions that weren't in fact boycott. Any resolution that expressed solidarity with Palestinians was being attacked by this group of MLA members as being unfair to Israel. And, you know, at times people were being accused of being anti-Semitic. So there had been some background to this, but in, I think it was 2015, the resolutions went to the MLA Delegate Assembly Organizing Committee to be put forward for discussion and debate at the, I guess it would have been at the 2015 MLA.
Yeah, it was the fall of 2014.
Yeah, so it was at that point that the MLA Delegate Assembly Organizing Committee suggested that we hold off, withdraw our resolutions temporarily at least, and allow for the two groups, our group, MLA Members for Justice in Palestine, and the other group, which is called MLA Members for Scholars' Rights, and educate the membership on this particular issue of academic boycott. Now, this all happened, of course, in the wake of the American Studies Association endorsing the academic boycott, and Asian American Studies and Native American Studies and many other groups that professional associations endorsing it. So so the idea was that the MLA membership wasn't quite prepared and that we, both groups, were asked to hold off and prepare the ground for a membership vote through a series of annual discussions that the MLA was going to allow to happen. And those included designated panels, a debate, a town hall meeting. And we accepted that. And so when it came to the end of the 3-year period in January 2017, the resolutions went to the Delegate Assembly for a vote. And there was special rules that were put in place. And we weren't really fully aware of those special rules. For example, they had strict time limits on the discussion. And during the Delegate Assembly meeting, which is the kind of like the parliament of the MLA or the Congress of the MLA, these are elected officials. Some of them are appointed, but many of them are elected representatives of various constituencies within the MLA. And it consists of a couple of hundred people. And they're the ones who vote on these resolutions, whether or not they go to the membership. And there were special rules put in place that limited the amount of time for discussion for each resolution. And we weren't really aware that this was going to happen. And there was a discussion that seemed to be abridged because of the time limits that were set, and not everybody was allowed to speak in favor of the boycott resolution and against this other resolution. There was a third resolution that was put forward, which was even more hostile to Palestinians in the sense that it blamed the Palestinians, it blamed the Palestinian Authority and Hamas for the violation of the academic freedoms of Palestinians without mentioning Israel. That was the third resolution, which was this series. And when the vote happened at the Delegate Assembly, we voted on all three resolutions, and then the results were given. And this was a little bit strange also because the vote on our resolution took place, and I think they voted on ours first. Is that right, Rebecca, on the boycott resolution? And then we voted on the anti-boycott resolution, and then yes, we voted on the other resolution, and then they revealed the results. And this was a little bit unusual because typically what would happen is you would vote on a resolution, and then they would show the results, and then you would vote on another resolution. But because these three resolutions were all tied together, we voted on the first two, and then what happened was Russell Berman withdrew, even though he wasn't the sponsor of the third resolution. He called for a motion to withdraw the third resolution because they had won that vote, and it was clear that the Delegate Assembly was not in favor of an academic boycott resolution. We were a little bit surprised that not only were they not in favor of an academic boycott, but they were actually hostile to it in the sense that they voted in favor by a small majority to support a preemptive resolution that called on the association to refrain from endorsing academic boycott. Then afterwards, it goes to the membership.
That's the voice of Salah Hassan of Michigan State University. Rebecca, as BDS campaigns grow in size and popularity, the MLA, with this vote against academic boycotts of Israel, is sending a clear message to academics who are Palestinian and those who advocate for Palestinian rights to be silent. What does it mean for the MLA to go in the opposite direction of where most student groups or academic associations or conversations on campuses are heading?
Well, it says a lot about, I mean, not only about the MLA, which I think is a is it is a large and on the conservative side, even within professional academic associations. But it speaks to, I think, a growing divide within the academic community in general between the sort of the profession itself and those who actually work and study within the profession. As you say, this is a time when critical awareness of Israel-Palestine is constantly rising, when the terms of the discussion, you know, has dramatically changed, even in the last 3 years during which the boycott has been under such discussion at the MLA and elsewhere, you know, with the student movements on campuses and all the grassroots organizing, and within the cultural sphere, increasing awareness and respect for the boycott as really a powerful. And at this point, the most effective measure that can be taken against the violations of human rights by Israel, it does show a severe disconnect between the MLA and the academic community that it is supposedly representing. So I don't know really what to account for it. I mean, I want to just kind of underline the oddity of this second resolution, which was a superfluous one. I mean, the boycott resolution had been defeated. So the resolution to not boycott or to refrain from boycott is an extra and quite aggressive layer, which makes a positive, it makes an actual statement. And it's important to underline, it's not just a statement against academic boycotts in principle in the name of academic freedom. It's actually a specific resolution against the boycott, the boycott that's been called for by PACB, by the Palestinian Civil Society. So it's a specific singling out, we might say, of Israel as exempt from boycott measures. So I think the resolution, more shocking even than that it was, that it passed not only the delegate assembly but also the ratification vote, was how few people actually managed to vote against it. The MLA has a voting rule by which a quorum has to be reached, and 10% of the membership. A resolution can only be passed if 10% of the membership vote for it. And that quorum was met by those who supported the anti-boycott resolution, but only half as many people voted against it. So there's a kind of apolitical drift within the association itself, which is as disturbing as anything else, how few people actually were, I think, possibly even aware of the importance of this boycott, of this anti-boycott resolution, or even that it was happening.
How will this affect students, scholars, and professors who are being targeted and harassed by Israel advocacy groups on U.S. campuses?
I think it will go a long way to encouraging repression at all levels, at the level of state legislation, where, as you know, some 19 states have already introduced anti-BDS legislation, sometimes quietly while everyone is distracted by the Trump shenanigans, and sometimes not so quietly, as well as the anti-protest measures. So we see on campuses everywhere this chapter of Students for Justice in Palestine is being closed down. This speaker, that speaker is being disinvited. This job search is being canceled. This faculty member is brought in for interrogation. And at a less official level, you know, all of the online and offline harassment, defamation, investigations, even threats to faculty and students who are supportive of or politically active in Palestinian solidarity. So this kind of it certainly fuels the fire of the repressive movements, both official and unofficial, on campuses everywhere, and gives a kind of credence, a tacit credence to much of the misinformation that is spread about anti-BDS as being anti-Semitic, for example. So I think it will have a destructive effect on the culture of dissent, both within the university and outside it. I think in the long term, it is. I don't think it's going to. I certainly don't think it's going to. It's the last word. It is a setback, as is only predictable, but it's a real one, and it raises the question really of where is the most effective way to concentrate our energies as activists. Are these large professional associations really the place to do that, or what are the options at this point?
That's Rebecca Comey of the University of Toronto. Salat, did you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think that just going back to your previous question about what does this mean for the MLA or how to interpret this, and really, I think that the MLA clearly is in a crisis mode right now in terms of, you know, the membership decline over the last 3 years has been close to 20%, I think. You know, they went from about 25,000 down to about 18,000 or 19,000. There's a real turnover now taking place in terms of the executive directors leaving. I think that, you know, there's a lot of concern about what is the status of the humanities and what is the role of the MLA in the future in advocating for the humanities. And so I think that anything that looks like an attempt at political action that is outside of the humanities is it's very difficult to get any leverage there within the MLA right now. And so in some respects, our initiative and our movement within the MLA to promote the boycott of Israeli academic institutions came at a difficult time and for the MLA. And understandably, the way that the anti-boycott position was, well, this is, you know, this isn't really the business of the MLA. Why is the MLA taking up this issue? So they were really effective in at least within a small, but you know, 10% of membership voted with them in making that argument and getting people on board. Now, I would say that there are some indicators that, you know, this is part of a conservative trend within the humanities, this kind of disengagement, but it's also being partly it's part of a mission that has been undertaken by a lot of pro-Israeli groups, is to make the argument that the academic boycott is a violation of academic freedom, and that's something else that was really used to undermine our position, which is that, you know, Palestinian human rights includes academic freedom of Palestinians. And so what they were able to do is you know, make a call for defending the rights of Israeli academics. And somehow that had a lot of appeal. But I think and I believe there's enough evidence to indicate that this was also widely supported from the Ministry of Strategic Affairs in Israel. And in fact, some of the very little reporting in Israel on the vote at the ML, the membership vote, but in the initial reporting from Israel after the delegate assembly vote indicated very clearly that the Ministry of Strategic Affairs was backing Carrie Nelson and Russell Berman, and that and there was some reporting in the Times of Israel that indicated that the ministry looked on this, the results of the membership vote, very favorably. So I don't think that's the external factors were the only factor, but I do think that they played a role and especially were important in that this had to be a victory for them in order to roll back the successes of BDS over the last 5 years. And so the MLA was kind of a test case for them. And I think that the MLA was propitious in the sense that it was the right site to do that, because you have very, I'm using this word in a kind of qualified manner, but very conservative elements in the sense that people are very concerned with protecting the profession. And this sort of protection of the profession, and like, why would we want to do any this? Endorsing the academic boycott might hurt the MLA. People will not want to be members of the MLA. It might be a violation of the law. The Brandeis Center sent in a letter saying that, you know, there would be a lawsuit against the MLA should they endorse the academic boycott. So these kinds of things were very effective in intimidating, but also mobilizing support against the boycott. And the MLA, unlike, I would say, the American Anthropology Association, where you have a longstanding commitment to social activism among anthropologists and a critique and critical anthropology, even though there's lots of criticism within the MLA, like critical work being done, if you look at the membership, you see that it's also very parochial and turned inward on the profession in ways that anthropology isn't. And I think just to add to that, for students, one of the things that we're seeing is that students, graduate students in particular, and I would say this extends to more and more faculty with adjuncts having limited ability to become members because it's expensive, the convention is very expensive, is that those individuals in the profession are increasingly marginalized from the MLA. And so what that means is that the higher paid faculty, the tenured faculty, mm-hmm. are the ones who are increasingly the majority and control more. And so I think that for more students, graduate students in particular, and adjunct faculty, who see themselves as being allied with progressive issues and with Palestine solidarity, this is going to push them to have a more opportunistic relationship with the association, not want to provide service, not want to be on committees, the association depends on members to participate in many of the constituent committees for the various areas of study. So people won't be willing to have a regular membership. You have to commit to a 3-year membership in order to do that. And so we're going to lose those constituents as regular members increasingly because they'll say, well, this isn't an association that represents me. I'm only going to become a member for a year to participate in the convention or because I'm applying for a job and I need to go to MLA or something like that.
And I just wanted to backtrack as the name that you brought up a couple times, Kerry Nelson, if that name is familiar to our listeners and to our readers, that's because he was heavily involved in backing the decision by the chancellor of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign in blocking the professorship of Stephen Saleta, of course, and for firing him 2 weeks before he was about to begin teaching. What are the next steps here in terms of the MLA members for Justice in Palestine? A couple of days ago came out with a statement protesting the ratification of the anti-BDS resolution at the MLA. What are the next steps for MLA members for Justice in Palestine and scholars and students who are still in support of backing the academic boycott?
Okay, well, there's more than one next step, and I think that's important to register within the MLA that different people are taking different courses of action. A lot of people are planning to resign from the MLA or already have, who find that they cannot continue to be aligned with an organization that has taken such a reactionary position. Though there are those who have decided to stay within the MLA and to continue to fight the battle within the MLA, which will involve, in the first place, getting this anti-boycott resolution rescinded so that the solidarity campaign can be continued. And both are very powerful responses and powerful tactics, and both are taking place at once. So what we're going to see is, on the one hand, a concerted exodus from the MLA, and on the other hand, a concerted restarting of the engine. But it's all happening, and many there's many reactions, and this is all part of the struggle.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Cassidy Craighill of Greenpeace USA, who assesses the climate issues that were the focus of some of the many protest actions at the recent G20 summit meeting of world leaders in Hamburg, Germany. Tony Harp, mayor of New Haven, Connecticut, who talks about resolutions calling for reductions in U.S. military spending that were adopted at the recent annual meeting of the U.S. Conference of Mayors. And Annie Bird, director of the Guatemala Human Rights Commission, who discusses a recent investigation into a 2012 DEA-led drug raid in Honduras that killed 4 civilians, which demands accountability. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
As Venezuela's political crisis continued to escalate, with a recent attack by government supporters targeting the opposition-controlled National Assembly, Mexico is working within the Organization of American States to negotiate a settlement between Venezuela's socialist president, Nicolas Maduro, and his political opponents. Mexico's president, Enrique Peña Nieto, has his own political future in mind as he focuses on Venezuela's turmoil. In next year's presidential election, Nieto's party, the ruling Institutional Revolutionary Party, or PRI, will face a formidable challenge from former Mexico City Mayor Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who narrowly lost the 2006 presidential race after being linked to Venezuela's leftist president Hugo Chávez. Nieto, who lost public support over his humiliating early dealings with Donald Trump, is now looking to play the Venezuela card in order to undercut his populist challenger. According to Armand Pichard's Fredroup of the center-right think tank, the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Mexico's political establishment has often exploited fear of a leftist takeover to isolate progressive candidates. However, there's an irony in Mexico drawing attention to rights abuses elsewhere in the hemisphere when its own human rights record is under severe scrutiny. Berta Zuniga, the daughter of slain rainforest activist Berta Cáceres, survived a violent attack only weeks after taking over the indigenous rights group her mother founded. Cáceres, the recipient of the prestigious Goldman Environmental Prize, was murdered in her home in March of 2016. Zuniga and 2 leading members of the Civic Council of Popular and Indigenous Organizations in Honduras were attacked during a community visit. The trio was blocked by a truck filled with men wielding machetes, and attackers later attempted to run Zuniga and her associate's vehicle off a cliff-edged road. Berta Cáceres, whose murder triggered international outrage, had for years faced intimidation and death threats. She had fought to defend the ancestral rights of the Lenca people from miners, loggers, and dam construction. 8 men were later arrested for Cáceres' murder, including 3 with links to the military, and others who worked for a construction company that built dams that the environmental activist opposed. More than 120 environmental activists have been killed in Honduras since a military-backed coup in 2009. After weeks of negotiations, California Governor Jerry Brown announced a proposed extension of the state's pioneering cap-and-trade carbon emissions program. The governor and legislative leaders will give new powers to the State Air Resources Board that will set a price for carbon in addition to monitoring fossil fuel industry pollution. During talks over the cap-and-trade program, Brown played an insider strategy. Instead of embracing progressive legislation endorsed by climate justice activists, Brown negotiated directly with California's powerful oil and gas industry. According to the news magazine In These Times, Brown crafted legislation behind closed doors and relied on talking points developed by the regional oil lobby, the Western State Petroleum Association. As negotiations went forward in Sacramento, climate activists were pushing for vigorous carbon reduction goals and aid for communities hurt by the fossil fuel industry. A cap-and-trade reform bill could have been a positive departure from current cap-and-trade regulations and would have barred the stockpiling of carbon credits, making them less vulnerable to the kind of speculation that triggered the 2008 financial crisis. The final compromise legislation, however, left current cap-and-trade regulations largely intact. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
An estimated 100,000 activists from across Europe and elsewhere converged on Hamburg, Germany, to engage in multi-issue protests at the Group of 20, or G20 summit meeting, July 7th and 8th. U.S. President Donald Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin were among the leaders of the G20 industrial nations who gathered in Hamburg to discuss trade, immigration, terrorism, and human rights. Although a group of militant protesters received most of corporate media attention due to their running street battles with some of the 20,000 police deployed in Hamburg, most of those protesting were peaceful. Activists who came to Hamburg organized an alternative summit meeting and participated in diverse actions designed to focus attention on issues including ongoing wars, climate change, threats to the environment, economic inequality, and the plight of immigrants. Greenpeace was among the many international non-governmental organizations with a presence in Hamburg, where members staged several actions. Activists in kayaks and small boats wrote the words "End Coal" on a ship delivering 75,000 tons of coal to the German port, while others scaled a city bridge and suspended a large banner with the same message, G20 End Coal. Your reporter spoke with Cassidy Craighill, a media officer with Greenpeace USA, who discusses the climate issues that were the focus of her group's protests at the G20 summit meeting.
Certainly a kind of beehive of activity at the G20, both in the official meetings and on the street. Greenpeace was there, and we obviously are an organization that prioritizes nonviolence. But the G20 certainly is a place where people can see the power imbalance. And so Greenpeace, at these types of events and gatherings on the world stage, pushes the narrative to really shift that power back into the hands of the people rather than corporate interests and the economic elite. So that was certainly one of our priorities there. The Paris Climate Agreement was, of course, one of the top agenda items this year, and we wanted to raise awareness to how much Trump had set us back, but not just the United States, the whole world, and send the message that that was not something that really reflected the needs and desires of people in the United States, but also people around the world. So the G20 is really a unique event where it is such a gathering of the most powerful in the world, but to have such a diverse group of protesters there was really important and I think really shifted the narrative this year.
Now, I know Greenpeace was focused on the continued burning of coal throughout the world, particularly industrial nations. And there was a coal ship, I believe, that was delivering shipment of coal to the Hamburg port. And Greenpeace had a creative way to focus their attention on the continued burning of coal and its contribution to climate change. You want to tell our listeners a bit about what happened with that coal ship?
Sure. And the coal action was one of a few that Greenpeace did during the G20. And the overall message there was that you can't have global climate action without phasing out the burning of coal. And shifting to 100% renewable energy. So we really wanted to point out some of the lip service that is often paid to climate action but still need some more substantial, significant steps to phasing out those fossil fuels, including coal, but also, of course, oil and gas, particularly in the United States. So Germany is one of the countries that is still too reliant on coal, yet is seen as a leader on climate change. And so that was a moment to really highlight that you can say all you want at these sorts of meetings, but unless you're actually backing it up with action and actually phasing out those 30 fossil fuel sources and energy sources, then we're really not making the progress at a global level that we need. So that was to really point out that even a country as progressive as Germany is still has an addiction to fossil fuel that needs to be addressed.
Cassidy, what was the response of the G20 nations to Donald Trump's announcement on June 1st that he's pulling out of the Paris Climate Accord? From what I understood, a lot of these leaders did reaffirm their commitment to the Paris Accord, some even bolstering their commitments that were made originally. But you could provide us a summary of some of the response of these world leaders to the Trump pullout.
Like you said, the rest of the G20 or the G19 really now needs to double down on their commitments. And I think it's up to people around the world to push those countries to do so, particularly ones that are in such a great position to do so. So Europe, Canada, Asian countries, I think all realize that they need to double down on those commitments and are doing so. I think at this point, of course, having the United States in that agreement would help. But the fact of the matter is that there are so many other forces in the United States that are moving forward with that progress. You know, the leading companies in this country, from Apple to Google to Facebook, are making their own commitments. Mayors around the country, from Virginia to San Francisco to the Southwest, all four corners and of the country are making their own commitments and moving forward on them. So I think that it's important for us to signal to the rest of the world that despite the president of the United States not listening to the majority of scientists in the world and not joining respected leaders in this agreement, that the rest of the United States is going to do so. And I think it's important for other leaders, particularly in the developing world, that in countries like India, to continue to push Trump to rethink this decision. They may be the only ones who have that leverage, and it's important for them. But in the meantime, Trump is not any sort of person to reason with. They need to be even more ambitious about their original commitments.
That was Cassidy Craighill, a media officer with Greenpeace USA. Find more news and commentary on the G20 summit meeting by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. At the close of its 85th annual meeting on June 26th, the United States Conference of Mayors, for the 12th consecutive year, adopted a strong resolution put forward by a coalition called Mayors for Peace, which called on President Trump to lower nuclear tensions, prioritize diplomacy, and redirect nuclear weapons spending to meet human needs and address environmental challenges, which was sponsored by Mayor Frank Crowney of Des Moines, Iowa, and 19 other co-sponsors. The Mayor's Conference also unanimously passed two complementary resolutions, one which opposed the Trump administration's proposal to move $54 billion from human and environmental spending at home and abroad to military spending, sponsored by Mayor Svante Mierick of Ithaca, New York. The other resolution called on cities across the U.S. to hold public hearings to explore what they could do with funds if major cuts were made to the nation's military budget. The resolution also urged cities to pass motions locally demanding reductions in military spending, moving the money saved to fund cities, and sending the resolution to members of Congress asking for their response. That resolution was submitted by New Haven, Connecticut Mayor Tony Harp, whose own city passed such a resolution in February. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus visited Mayor Harp in her office recently and spoke with her about the resolution she initiated and the differing responses to her call for reductions in military spending since the advent of the Trump presidency.
This resolution that looks at our federal spending on our war apparatus and sort of moving into peacetime operation just made sense in light of an administration that actually wants to pour more dollars into our armed forces and our war apparatus. It's going in the exact opposite way than we thought we were going, I don't know, 2 years ago.
Do you feel like, you know, there's resistance growing to the Trump administration in ways that could be effective, or do you fear that with the federal government reestablishing its priorities in a very different way that you're going to have a hard time in the future?
Well, you know, I think that we are in a very precarious place in America, that you have in North Korea a very unstable leader who now claims that he can get a warhead, a nuclear warhead, to American lands. And we have a president who doesn't seem to be at all concerned that the world really cannot contemplate nor have a nuclear war, and really uses language and tweets that I think endanger the American people. So having said that, and then decides that it's going to use the resources of the American people, not for Medicaid, not for Meals on Wheels, not for youth at work, not for any of the labor programs, and is going to use it so that it can play this game with the rest of the world that really leverages all of our lives. I'm very worried about it. And I think other mayors are too. And when you look at cities in America, almost all of the cities are blue, which basically means they care a lot about communities, people, and making sure they have the resources to care for people. But oftentimes they're in red states. And the way in which our democracy has been designed with the Electoral College makes it a red state like Wyoming have more say, basically, or an individual in that state have more say than people in a blue state with more population have. The few get to decide where the many go. And that is a problem, and it is dangerous, and I'm worried about it. I think most mayors are.
You said a lot of cities, most cities are blue, but there were Republican mayors here.
Oh, there were absolutely Republican mayors there, and not all of them are blue, but some of the major cities typically with the larger populations are blue in the United States, oftentimes in red states. And so it creates a bit of a problem, but most all of those cities that are blue, they are standing behind the Paris Climate Pact. They are standing behind and fighting for the resources that the people in their cities need at the federal level. And, you know, they're putting pressure on Congress to really be a balance of power. Again, you know, Congress is laid out with largely Republican, although in the cities that are represented by these folks, there's still a lot of pressure. They've got to go home to say why they don't want to pay for medical care for people, why they don't want to make sure that poor people who can't afford food don't have access to it. And so hopefully at the local level, holding our federal leaders' feet to the fire, we can move away from what appears to be somewhat suicidal. You know?
But you did say the resolution passed unanimously. Is that right?
Yeah, it passed.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So even these Republican mayors thought it was okay?
Thought it was okay.
I wonder, do you think that's because they thought it didn't really require, I mean, every city could do what it wanted to, I guess.
Well, I think that part of it is that, you know, you are bringing decision-making back to the local area. In a way, that's really very bright, because what happens is that you are able then to help people at the local level understand what's at stake. And hopefully it'll start a movement.
That was New Haven, Connecticut Mayor Tony Harp. Learn more about the resolutions adopted at the recent gathering of the U.S. Conference of Mayors by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. A U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration-supported narcotics interdiction raid in Honduras in May 2012 that killed 4 civilians, including 2 women and a 14-year-old boy, received new attention recently with the May 2017 release of a report by Inspectors General of the Departments of State and Justice. The report refuted an initial account filed by the DEA that stated the Honduran attack on a civilian boat by a DEA-led Honduran police unit and a U.S. machine gun-equipped helicopter was justified, and found that DEA and State Department officials had misled Congress. According to Annie Byrd, director of the Guatemala Human Rights Commission, the attack, which took place in the rural Mosquito indigenous community of Hawass on the Honduran Caribbean coast, shines a light on the need for close scrutiny of U.S. support for the drug war in Central America. Byrd and Alexander Main of the Center for Economic and Policy Research had visited Hawass several weeks after the May 2012 attack and collected firsthand accounts from survivors and eyewitnesses that directly contradicted the DEA's version of events. Their op-ed piece, titled "The Deadly Results of a DEA-Backed Raid in Honduras," was published in the New York Times on July 2nd. Your reporter reached Annie Byrd in Honduras, where she described the 2012 attack and the need for oversight and investigations by Congress into U.S. security operations and funding for counter-narcotics missions in Central American nations.
The incident that happened in 2012, the killing of 4 innocent bystanders and 3 others were currently disabled, was a very tragic event because it became pretty clear early on that it was the DEA that was directly involved. So the DEA was claiming that it had been a Honduran-led operation and that none of the people involved in the shooting had actually been DEA agents. So I traveled out to watch with Alex Main from the Center for Economic and Political Research, and we interviewed witnesses and survivors of the attack, and it became very clear there was a family who was moving from one town to another, had all of their belongings, had the school records for a 14-year-old boy who was killed because he was transferring from one school to the other. Their families, the 2 women said they were pregnant. You know, one of them, the doctor who had been seeing her, affirmed this. And you know, there's all kinds of evidence showing that this was a water taxi and that it was traveling on the river because that's how people in that area travel, and was mistaken by this DEA-led operation. And the DEA then ordered the Honduran gunners on the helicopter to open fire on the boat. It became very clear that the DEA was actually in charge of the operation, that the Honduran agents were under the orders, under the command of the DEA, and that the DEA in the United States was not being honest about that. But then what became even more concerning is that the DEA and State Department began promoting a story in Congress when Congress began asking questions that individuals on the water taxi had opened fire on a boat DEA and Honduran police officers were on. And there was no evidence to substantiate that. And in fact, what happened is that there was a witness who essentially lied, admitted she lied, gave contradictory evidence, you know, declarations in 3 different interviews. And so it was a very intentional sort of misleading of Congress and the public. So this whole incident provided a very disturbing sort of window into how the DEA is interacting with Honduran, not only drug networks, but also the corruption in the police forces that they're working with.
Annie, tell us about the issue of accountability here. Your article emphasizes the fact that no one at the Drug Enforcement Administration has been held accountable for the lies and misdirection that they gave State Department and Justice Department investigators.
Exactly, and what the State Department and DEA, what we're hearing that their response is that, well, this Inspector General report that came out with all these very damning findings is no longer relevant because the unit that undertook that operation was dissolved. Well, the fact of the matter is, the way that we see it, the most disturbing aspect of what happened was how the DEA and the State Department dealt with it afterwards by going along with lies, perpetuating, you know, misinformation, promoting false testimony. And all of that, you know, was with the infrastructure, the DEA office in the country, you know, the INL, the International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Unit for the State Department. And they actively participated in undermining the ambassador's chief of mission authority over their operations and in hiding what had actually happened in the operation and how they had later reacted to it.
Your investigation into this situation in Honduras shines a light on a pattern of behavior by the United States in terms of its involvement in Central American governments and the drug trade there that really provides much caution in your mind that the Congress really needs to investigate this and scrutinize very heavily what the U.S. DEA and other security assistance programs are doing to these countries where innocent civilians are being killed, as well as corruption is rife in local police departments and the military.
Exactly. There's this Central America Regional Security Initiative, CARSI, which was created in 2009 and has received billions of dollars, which are completely opaque. Their use, Congress does not know, you know, what those funds are being used for, and we're talking about billions of dollars. And our fear is that that funding, of what we see evidence to suggest, is that some of that funding could actually be promoting networks of corruption and feeding into the power structures of the actual criminal organizations that we're supposed to be combating. I mean, just as a tiny little microcosm example, I have serious reasons to believe and indications that the false witness, who was herself connected to organized crime, was likely paid by either the Honduran government or potentially assistance funds to the Honduran government, may be intended for witness protection or to promote access to information. And what I've seen in other areas of the country is payments being offered to people to give false testimony, essentially to protect drug traffickers or death squads who are stealing land from cooperative farmers.
That was Annie Bird, director of the Guatemala Human Rights Commission and co-author with Alex Main of the July 2nd New York Times op-ed piece titled "The Deadly Results of a DEA-backed Raid in Honduras." Find links to the article and related information by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WBSU in Brockport, New York, WTND in Macomb, Illinois, KAOS in Olympia, Washington, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
Our recent hepatitis C case was decided January 3rd, 2017. We thought that the state, known widely for its repressive penal attitudes and its cold resistance to the principle that prisoners were, after all, human beings entitled to the rights, privileges, and protections inherent in human personality, would be deeply impacted. We were correct, in a sense. For the case Abu Jamal versus Wetzel did indeed change the legal rules of the game, at least on paper. In practice, however, the fiendish protocol, first announced in the December 2015 hearings in our case, which stubbornly demands that people who are infected with a hepatitis C virus must be at death's door before even being considered for possible treatment, remains to this day to be DOC's practice and procedure, despite being found unconstitutional twice. But beyond Pennsylvania's archaic frontiers, the case is making ripples in the lives of thousands of other prisoners who are suffering the ravages of Hep C or HCV, like in the state of Missouri, where prisoners Michael Prostowski, Christopher Baker, and Michael Jamerson filed the class action suit against the Missouri Department of Corrections, or MDOC, claiming inadequate medical care for their HCV viral infections and the refusal of MDOC and Corizon Incorporated, MDOC's health care provider, to treat plaintiffs with a direct-acting antiviral known to resolve and actually cure HCV in a timely manner. When MDOC officials filed their motions to dismiss the case, the U.S. District Court in Missouri's Western District granted their motion in part, but also denied a huge chunk of their motions, finding that the prisoner plaintiffs had indeed shown a serious medical need, HCV, that MDOC defendants showed deliberate indifference to their medical needs, and that the plaintiffs had shown a reasonable probability of success on the merits of their complaint. To do this, the court used the U.S. Supreme Court's precedent on medical issues called Estelle versus Gamble, a 1976 case, and the recent Abu Jamal decision of January 2017. Because of that medical precedent, the lives of thousands of men and women in Missouri prisons just got better, and their lives were extended and perhaps saved. We have little doubt that the medical and corporate interest denying medical treatment here and there will continue to drag their feet and deny relief. But a dam has burst, and the dike has sprung, and HCV is under serious attack. The HCV prison wars have begun, and we are winning. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Following is a repeat broadcast of the Global Research News Hour, which originally aired July 1st, 2016. You're listening to a special presentation of the Global Research News Hour. My name is Michael Welch. On this week's holiday edition, we spend the hour listening to Dennis Edney on the rule of law and the politics of fear. The speech was presented on the evening of June 19th, 2015. at the Broadway Disciples United Church in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, in occupied Anishinaabe territory in the homeland of the Métis Nation. Dennis Edney was the lawyer for Omar Khadr, a Canadian who had been held in America's notorious Guantanamo Bay detention facility in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, for 10 years before being returned to Cuba in 2012. Khadr had been born in Canada in 1986. His father, Ahmed, an Egyptian and Palestinian immigrant, had moved the family back and forth between Canada and Pakistan for years. Following the September 11th attacks, the family had moved to the Pakistani mountains. In early 2002, the 15-year-old Omar had been placed with a group of Arabs in Khost, Afghanistan. In the village of Abu Kail, the house Omar had been staying in came under heavy fire from U.S. forces as part of their invasion of the country, meant to dislodge the Taliban from power. The boy had sustained heavy injuries. However, he was later charged with allegedly throwing a grenade during the firefight that resulted in the death of an American soldier. Dennis Edney first got involved with Khadr in 2003. After a lengthy process, Khadr pled guilty to the charge of murder in violation of the laws of war, attempted murder in violation of the laws of war, conspiracy, two counts of providing material support for terrorism, and spying. This was a plea deal, which would have seen him released to Canadian custody. Omar was brought to Canada September 29th, 2012, to serve the remainder of his sentence. On May 7th, 2015, Khadr was freed on bail with strict conditions, including living with and under Edney's supervision. On February 18th, 2016, the newly elected Liberal federal government dropped the appeal started by the previous Harper government that sought to revoke his bail. In this interview, we'll hear Dennis Edney tell Omar Khadr's story and put it in the wider context of the then Harper government's draconian policies and failure to respect the rule of law. The speech was followed by a brief question and answer period. So here is Dennis Edney on the rule of law and the politics of fear on the Global Research NewsHour.
I've been saying to people, you know, I feel like John the Baptist. I've been in the desert for years, and all of a sudden I come home to the village and people are glad to see me. And I was trying to understand that, seriously trying to understand that, because I've been wandering through this desert for quite a long time. I've been fighting every challenge put up against me by this Canadian government, and been successful every time. I'm successful in the US Supreme Court, but don't run out and hire me, because I lost every pretrial challenge in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. But I'm trying to understand why people were so happy about seeing me after all those years was the fact that because I felt lonely for years. You know, when you do a journey like Omar Khadr and you do complicated cases like I do, unless you, it's not easy. And I felt lonely in that journey because, you know, people pass you by. You want the world to believe in what you're doing. You want lawyers who are your colleagues to be knocking on your door saying, "Can I help you?" I want to avoid going to my wife once more for money, and so on and so forth. It's a long-winded way of saying what I realized has happened here is that many, many people in Canada felt that we wouldn't get Omar Khadr out, that you can't defeat power, particularly powerful power in the hands of governments. And the reality is, you can. It may not be easy, it may be slow, but you can. And I've lectured on this for years. I've said to little kids and I've said to students, I'm a powerful guy, and I used to joke, I used to show my muscles, and the big kids didn't get it. You know, they look at this body and think, forget it. Yeah, listen. But I'm just giving you a little anecdote tonight before I start, because we are powerful. We are. If we believe in justice, and if we uphold the principles of justice, it's hard to take you down. When you're talking about human dignity, How does someone, unless he's an absolute bigot, argue against you? And the second thing you do then, you do what I do. You make people accountable. You make your politicians accountable. So I better stop talking because I could take you on a different track tonight than what you're here for. The subject matter of Omar Khadr, as I've said on numerous occasions, is so extensive and complex that my talk this evening can't do it any justice. His story touches from the human to the inhuman, from the legal to the illegal. I could simply sum it up by saying I've never met anybody who has been so abused and so abandoned by so many who should know better. In a few months, Omar will turn 29 years of age, having now spent almost half of his life in conditions that raised international condemnation from human rights organizations, from jurists, from United Nations, and so on, but not by our government. And in my talks, I talk about the right to justice and the entitlement of each and every one of us to protection from inhuman, degrading, abusive treatment, simply because we're human beings. Those principles, I suggest to you, are non-negotiable. It is the core value of a civil society. Yet, it was a memo from the Bush administration that declared that the Geneva Conventions did not apply to allegedly captured terrorists on the battlefield of Afghanistan. The message was loud and clear. The rule of law would not apply to any suspects in the war on terror. And it was that memo that introduced Omar to a life of terror behind the secret walls of Guantanamo Bay. And Guantanamo Bay is simply a place without rules. And it's a place where Omar spent 10 years of his life, where he had been arbitrarily detained, suffered unjust imprisonment, prolonged solitary confinement, torture, and other humiliations. And all the while, our government, through then Foreign Affairs Minister Peter MacKay, persisted in telling each and every one of you here that he has been assured that Omar is being treated humanely and would take the United States at his word. Even though every other Western nation had demanded the release of their detainees in Guantanamo Bay, adults every one of them, and that was granted. International condemnation of Guantanamo Bay in those early days was full of concern about torture. And yet, we are the only government, Western government, never criticized Guantanamo Bay. We simply left a boy, a 15-year-old boy, in hell. The fact that torture has taken place in Guantanamo and that Omar has been subject to different forms of torture during his 10 years in Guantanamo is simply a matter of public record. It's not something I'm making up. And you only have to look no further than a 2008 Supreme Court of Canada decision stating that the United States had violated the International Convention on Torture and the Geneva Conventions with regards to Omar Khadr, and that Canada had also been complicit in his torture. And So I say to you, there can be no greater betrayal of Canadian values and our standing in the international community than our government having been implicated in something so utterly horrible as the torture of a Canadian citizen, a youth at that, Omar Khadr. And when that decision came out, it took me 5 years of climbing up to the Supreme Court of Canada, having gathered all kinds of evidence to demonstrate Canada's complicity in Guantanamo. And when the court agreed with my position, the next day I expect a parade outside the house. And there was no public outrage when the decision came out, and there's been very little outrage since. As a matter of fact, when you hear all the questions in the media, not once do they refer back to the 2008 decision that Canada had tortured one of its own. We, each and every one of us, have never made our government accountable for abandoning our constitution, sullying our reputation that others fought hard for. We have all become complicit by our very silence. And history tells us there are some cases that enshrine the defining moments of their time. Omar Khadr's case and the war is one. Future generations will rightly judge our shocking dereliction of responsibility in this matter and our collective failure to extend justice and humanity. And as we, all of us, have failed Omar, we have also failed our children through bequeathing to them an uncertain future as a result of systemic apathy by its citizens and our institutions. I say to you, in my sort of dark view of things, Omar's story, to me anyway, provides a frightening lens into the future of democracy and the decline of the rule of law as we see it. And one has to look no further than the story of Guantanamo Bay to understand how easy it is for a nation to fall into lawlessness. It was in January of 2002 that we, many of us here this evening, these things, witnessed on television the first shocking images of prisoners hooded and shackled for transportation across the Atlantic to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Much as other human beings had been carried in slave ships 400 years ago. And many of those prisoners were described by Human Rights Watch as no more than being farmers and taxi drivers sold by the Northern Alliance to the Americans on the war on terror. And in preparing for that 24-hour trip to Guantanamo, they would be zipped into an orange jumpsuit, hog-chained, meaning they were shackled around their ankles with a waist chain binding their hands to their stomach. And those chains were pulled so tight that many prisoners to this day were still left with the scars. And on the plane, they would be forced into sensory deprivation gear that the US military uses to disorient prisoners prior to interrogation. Opaque goggles covered their eyes, soundproof earphones over their ears and nose, and a mask and a hood over their heads. They were now ready to be bolted, fully trussed, to a backless steel bench or lying prone on the floor of a transport plane for the overseas flight. And I recall Omar telling me about his trip. And he said, "You know, Mr. Redney, 3 days prior to leaving, we were not given any food and only sips of water. And I later discovered this was to ensure that no detainee would require toilet facilities for the long trip to Cuba." Imagine treating your family pet that way. It wouldn't be long before your neighbour came by and you'd be cited for cruelty to animals. And that's exactly how those human beings were believed to be. They were inhuman. And on arrival in Guantanamo, they'd be dumped onto the tarmac of Guantanamo Airport like so much baggage, to be loaded then into a truck and deposited into wire cages, 6 feet by 6 feet seven, which would be their home for many years, irrespective of the searing heat the tropical storms. And what we were witnessing was not a manifestation of the Geneva Conventions at work, nor was it an act of deportation or extradition. It was worse. It was far worse. It was the unlawful transportation to a world outside the reach of the law and intended to remain so, and introduced to that life of terror behind those secret walls was a 15-year-old Canadian boy, the only child left in Guantanamo Bay. In fact, I was in New York and I was approached by a representative of Human Rights Watch, and what she said to me was, as I digress, what she said to me was, there were 24 kids in Guantanamo in 2002 picked up and deposited there, and the Bush administration contacted us and asked our assistance in reintegrating these kids back to where they came from. And the only name that wasn't on the table was Omar Khadr. And I asked her why. Why, she thought, why would that be? And she said, well, the message is that Canada doesn't care. The government doesn't care. No one stood up for him. So he was left there. And I should say, however, that Omar's story starts much earlier, for those who are not familiar with it. At the age of 12, his father had moved the Khadr family from Toronto to work in Pakistan and then Afghanistan. And when Afghanistan was invaded by the US, the country was in turmoil. Many sought safety in the mountains regions of Pakistan, including the Khadr family. However, Omar's father abandoned him by leaving him in the hands of a small group of Taliban warriors in a compound, promising to return and pick him up, and he never did. And 6 weeks later, the compound was attacked by US forces. It was bombed and reduced to rubble, and Omar was the only survivor. And when this dust settled, a Delta Force soldier going by the pseudonym of OC-1, he gave evidence at Omar's so-called trial, stated he saw Omar crouched on his knees, facing a blank wall, screaming from the bombing and shrapnel that had permanently blinded his left eye. And that soldier then shot him twice in the back. And that action in itself constituted a war crime under international law. And 3 days later, and contrary to all expectations, in fact it was a week later, Omar regained consciousness at the US Naval Base Hospital in Bagram, Afghanistan. And whatever horrors went on in Guantanamo started in Bagram. From the moment Omar gained consciousness, little did he realize that his life had changed forever. Despite the fact that he was suffering from extensive shrapnel wounds to much of his body, that the bones in his left shoulder and chest were shattered from bullet wounds, or that he was now partially blind, he would be taken into an interrogation room with his hands and feet shackled to a stretcher, leaving him unable to resist the horrors that were soon to be penetrated on him. And all the while, pain medication would be withdrawn in preparation for these sessions. And when his interrogators didn't like the answers they were given, Omar would then be forced into stress positions. That is, his injured and pained body would be placed into unnatural positions, which caused an agonizing pain in this young boy, screaming and sobbing uncontrollably. It was then that his captors would then take a bright pencil light and shine it directly into his damaged eyes, causing even more pain and even more damage that he suffers from today. And Damien Corsetti, one of the torturers who participated in that torture, has publicly stated We did terrible things to that boy. And he has reached out to Omar on a number of occasions seeking forgiveness. You know, the interrogation team that committed and perpetrated torture in the hospital in Bagram on Omar and others, you know that team. Many of you may remember the pictures of an American soldier smoking, standing on the naked bodies of Muslim human beings in the Abu Ghraib prison. And that was the team that started off in Bagram and did so well in Bagram that they got promoted to Guantanamo and then from Guantanamo on to Abu Ghraib. And as Omar became, I should tell you more, I should say to you that Sergeant Claus was the leader of this interrogation team. And I may have touched upon it in my talk, but I think it's important to tell you, he was the leader of that team. Damien Cassetti, whom I've met a number of times over the years, when I first met him, he can't stand himself. He was 20 years of age when he was trained to do the interrogations that he did. He can't stand his body. He just shakes all over and his skin feels like it's coming off. And then in the documentary that I'm in called You Don't Wish to Know the Truth, he opens his shirt and he'll show you he's got this big tattoo that says, I'm a monster. But Sergeant Claus, his leader, was an even greater monster. And I remember dealing with him at the trial in Guantanamo, and he was a hero there, actually. And he was dressed all in black. And he acknowledged that, yes, he may have been a bit more harsh with a young boy than he had been with adults. Think of that kind of human being. It's easier to pick on a child than adults. And as Omar became more mobile, he would be taken into the interrogation room with a black hood placed over his head, intending to disorient him. And Omar described the suffocating feeling he experienced as the hood was wrapped tightly around his neck, nearly choking him. And he would panic, scream out to his interrogators that it was difficult to breathe. And they would just laugh at him, as barking, snarling dogs were then brought in the room to further terrify him. It's all about fear. It's all about humiliation. But more significantly, for me anyway, he would be made to stand on his toes in a crucifix position for hours at a time, with his arms outstretched to the upper parts of a door jamb and hung by the wrists. So eventually, supporting your weight becomes an unbearable strain. And his ankles and feet would swell twice to their size. Moving became agonizing. And while in these positions, this young Omar would urinate on himself. And that was the best time for the team. Because he would then be untied and he would use his head as a floor mop to clean up the urine. While at the same time he would be threatened with rape and other humiliating acts, which I don't care to describe any further. You know, I questioned the chief nurse of the Bagram ward that Omar was in. And she said nothing went on there, nothing at all. And then we had a former US Army medic who contacted us and wanted to give evidence at the trial. Of course, he wasn't permitted to be there because Omar had no witnesses at his trial. And he stated that he once found Omar Carroll chained to the door frame of a 5-foot-square wire cage with his arms suspended above his shoulders, hooded and weeping. Imagine that frightening picture of a 15-year-old boy. Imagine your own child, your own brother, your own sister. It's just unbelievable. It's evil. And another technique would be, it was called the night shift. where Omar would walk up and down the hallways throughout the night carrying buckets of water in each hand. And on reviewing the few medical notes that we were able to get, a nurse noted that his wounds would weep and would seep with blood during this activity. And we're talking about a 15-year-old then. And a former British detainee who was in Guantanamo and then his government had him released, and whom I interviewed said, "We could hear Omar's cries and moans day and night until we were separated from him. And we all felt bad for him because he was just too young." And I particularly recall the story Omar tells me of the US soldier who would come to his bedside regularly in that hospital. He would then drop his pants, stick his naked bum in Omar's face, and then fart. And people would laugh. Nurses, soldiers would laugh. And so imagine, I've always thought of hospitals as a sacred place, a place where humanity is shown, a place of healing. And we turned that hospital, it was nothing more than an evil place. And I've told you that during this time, Omar's principal interrogator at the Bagram Hospital was Sergeant Joshua Claus. You could check him out. Check him out on the internet. Check him out on Google. He questioned Omar over a 3-month period for up to 6 hours at a time. And Claus later pled guilty to killing one detainee in Bagram and crippling two others, using the same techniques that he used on Omar, except he's a bit rougher on Omar. And in his defense, he said that he felt he pressured to get results. But the government did a deal. He didn't go to prison. The government had him, they gave him immunity so that he could testify at Omar's trial that Omar confessed to him that he had thrown a hand grenade at Sergeant Claus. It's unbelievable, the irony of that. And Omar Khadr was interviewed, gave his press conference. He was asked about, "Did you throw a hand grenade?" And he said, "I don't know." Because he's so truthful. He didn't know. Because from the moment he gained consciousness, and through the years, as they do to each and every detainee, they force the answers that they want. And Omar knew what they wanted eventually, because they told him, You killed Sergeant Claus. You killed Sergeant Claus. To the point Omar had to acknowledge that because he knew more pain was coming when he didn't. And Omar described the predominant sound in that hospital ward were the cries of pain from others being abused and tortured. It was just a few days ago that before I came out here, I was on the phone speaking to this human rights organization called CAGE in London, run by former Guantanamo detainees. And I was explaining how Omar was doing. And they then were talking about how they were doing. And they talked about some of their abuses. And, you know, I've been on this road a long time. But I found myself, my eyes welling up, I found I was going to cry. And so I said, "Look, I'll have to call you back." So I say to you, it goes against the very core of humanity that torture and abuse of anyone, let alone a 15-year-old, would take place in a hospital where people are at their most vulnerable. And whatever horrors he experienced them in the Bagram Hospital, followed him to Guantanamo Bay. And they included beatings, humiliation, sleep deprivation, and so on and so on and so on and so on. And I recall my first meeting with Omar. because he had been moved from the cages to one of the secret prisons in Guantanamo. You know of the cages, but we don't publicize that there are three secret prisons in Guantanamo, big concrete prisons, blocks in the desert, which the Pentagon says designed for enhanced interrogation techniques, namely torture. And I won't go on too much about Omar anymore, but I would say to you that when I saw Omar Khadr, I was shocked at the sight of this tragic, lonely figure. He reminded me of a small, broken bird all curled up and into himself. And I recall the involuntary gasp at the sight of him that I had such difficulty in controlling my emotions. I was supposed to be the Adam, I was supposed to be the lawyer, and I wanted to find someone to speak to, someone to hug me, someone to tell me what was going on there. Because I was a father and could not believe what I was seeing. I had young children, and I knew they were in the comfort and safety and security of my wife. And so that first image of Omar haunted me for years. This so very dejected, lonely figure abandoned by all. And every time I left Omar after a visit, I was aware that the fluorescent lights in his cell would remain on 24 hours a day, that he would try to sleep the time away, and that the cold in his cell would prevent sleep, and that incessant lighting had divested him of his feel for night and day. And throughout my numerous years of visiting him in Guantanamo Bay, I never ever saw him walking, as he was always shackled to the floor. I grew up with Omar Khadr sitting on a chair and him sitting on a stool. And he was a young boy, now he's a big tall man, bigger than myself. You know, in looking at the military dossier records, demonstrate as a result of the unrelenting maltreatment of Guantanamo detainees, there were several hundred suicide attempts. And it's in the documents also stated a high percentage of detainees are on antidepressants. And the report also indicated that at least 100 have become observably mentally ill as opposed to just being depressed. So Omar is often referred by our government as a terrorist who committed a heinous crime, who pleaded guilty to those charges. He does so without any backdrop leading to the plea bargain. The American military tribunal in Guantanamo Bay that convicted Omar was not a normal court. It was a pantomime of justice, removed from the normal American legal system and relying on made-up rules and novel legal interpretations. Some would say a kangaroo court, one worthy of a Middle Eastern dictatorship or a Kafkaesque story. Or as the Alberta Court of Appeal put it recently, in dryly damning language, the legal process under which Khadr was held and the evidence elicited from him have been found to have violated both the Charter and international human rights law. And you know, the Supreme Court of Canada said also as much, which flies in the face of the constant language from our government and from Mr. Blaney, who keeps saying the same two lines without any backdrop. And whatever I'm telling you here, they know. In Guantanamo, every time we had a hearing, officials from the Department of Foreign Affairs were present. I would speak to them. I recall one time saying to an official from the Department of Foreign Affairs, if we don't get him out of one of those secret prisons, he's going to die. And she said, I know. And before he pled guilty, he made it clear that he didn't want to do so. He said to me that Canadians would think that he is a terrorist. And I said, not at all. Canada, when they get to see you, hear you, will see a different person. Well, you saw him recently, but in the 2 years he's been here, the Canadian government has fought all the way to make sure you don't get to see him or hear him. And on his return to Canada, he didn't get to see the Canadian public because Mr. Taze, who is a former minister, seems to have a problem reading documents. Because I send him documents from the Pentagon and from the judge advocate in Guantanamo that expressed that he was nothing more than a good kid. But Mr. Tate's eyesight can't be that good because he read it in a different kind of way. Because he determined that Omar Khadr was a security risk to Canada and to any prisoner in any maximum security prison. And because of that, we located him in Millhaven, where Bernardo and other people were there. And we locked him up for 7.5 months in solitary confinement. And on the day he was released into the prison population, an inmate attempted to stab him and then placed a contract on his life. So I was then able to secure his transfer to a maximum security prison in Edmonton. And on arrival, he was placed on a white supremacist unit, the only Muslim. And within minutes, he was assaulted. And I recall that terrible, terrible day for me. It was the worst day in all my years with Omar. I met a very sad and frightened Omar. Up and until in Guantanamo, he had kept himself together. He'd come back here with hope. And here he was crying to me. And I remember the reality that I faced then, that I couldn't do anything. I couldn't take him out. I couldn't take him home with me. I had to send him back up those stairs, back to those idiots that were waiting for him. In chronicling Omar's ordeal, I'm not simply describing shameful and appalling behavior towards a young Canadian youth that should shock the conscience of all of us, or that he has managed against all odds to maintain an enduring faith in our common humanity, or that his truth has been able to leap prison walls and barriers. It is all of that. It is only by creating a climate of fear that it is easy for people to accept, such as ourselves, that drastic measures must be taken in the interest of security, even if it means the suspension of civil liberties, compromising our values, or ignoring the rule of law. We rationalize it's for the greater good of society. It is then that we fall into lawlessness. So as I conclude, our generation has had the most sophisticated development of international laws, treaties and conventions the international community has ever known, all stating that human rights abuses will not be tolerated. And these international conventions include the Geneva Conventions, the Convention on Torture, the Convention on the Rights of the Child, and many, many more, all applicable to Omar Khadr, and all denied him. As a result of the international consensus reflected in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the Charter of the United Nations, that no one in the future would fall outside the protection of the law has been overridden and supplanted by lawlessness. We only have to look at that hellhole, Guantanamo Bay, that still exists. And as a signatory to all these international treaties, our government has an obligation to protest when they are not being applied to one of its citizens. And not once did it complain to the Americans about its obligations under international law to Omar Khadr. Canada, which is us, which was once viewed as a leader in human rights and upholding the rule of law, is now responsible for undermining those very protections. So Omar's story provides a frightening lens into the future of democracy and the decline of the rule of law as we knew it. Because his story is not just about a young boy who was detained and abused. His story is also about how we as individuals define ourselves as a society and what we are prepared to stand up for. And if this could happen to a 15-year-old Canadian youth, then tell me, assure me, how could any one of us, including our children, ever feel safe? And so I've given you the harsh treatment, the reality. And so I was asked outside a question, had I lost faith? Not at all, ladies and gentlemen. Not the slightest. I have seen such humanity from one end of Canada to the other. When I started off, I kind of mumbled about what it all meant about this bail hearing. What this bail hearing meant for Canada was that we can, even a simple guy like myself from Dundee in Edmonton, Alberta, if I can take, and my co-counsel Nate Whitland can take on big governments and be successful, then so can any of you. I was no international lawyer. I'm a former carpenter, former truck driver, lawyer. You know, not sure what I put them all. But I just felt that a situation was imposed upon me that I could not walk away. How could I walk away from that child and live with myself? And it didn't matter whether I won or not. What was important that I took those steps. That's what's important. We stand up and let people know that we stand up for justice. The word justice I use almost like a religious term, even though I'm far from being religious. That's my wife. She complains I don't go to church with her. Justice is a beautiful word because it does away with barriers. It does away with different religious organizations. It does away with color. And what it dresses you in is power. Because how can you take me on? You, Mr. Government, for example. When I'm talking about fundamental principles of humanity, how do you argue against that? You can't. So I thank you very much for listening to me. One other point then. Is that I have had over 1,000 emails in the last few weeks, with the exception of one email. Everyone says, thank you, Mr. Redney. And the other part is, we feel better as Canadians. I live in this pretty conservative area where most of my neighbors are Jewish. And I think you have to be a doctor to get into the area. And I hardly ever see my neighbours. But you know, since Omar's release, my neighbours have knocked on the door to bring cake, to bring food, to provide flowers, to welcome Omar home. And if you watched the press conference, there were some neighbours shouting at the end of the press conference, welcome Omar. And Omar has been welcomed by all kinds of Canadians. My wife was in West Edmonton Mall and some chap was buying ice cream and he saw Omar and he bought Omar a cone. I was at Omar in Home Hardware and this big bruiser, I don't know how old he was, about 50-ish, he looked pretty rough. Looked at me with an evil eyes, he went by me and then he turned around, bypassed me, walked right up to Omar and said, you're Omar. He says, you know, I don't like Americans. I don't like what they did to you, and I wish you the best. So no matter where he is turned. People are not intrusive, but they want to send a message to him. We're glad you're here. Thank you very much.
My question for you was, do you think that you could have set a draft for a new legal precedent when dealing with alleged terrorists?
Could I have done a what? I'm sorry.
Do you think that you could have set a draft for a new legal precedent when dealing with alleged terrorists?
No.
In this case?
No. It's When you're making a determination, when you're dealing in terrorism, for example, and I've been involved in terrorism for years, the rule of law always applies. It's not a utilitarian analysis of what's best for the many against the rights of the few. That goes against the whole basis of justice. We want to ensure that we send the message to anybody who has committed harm in society that we are human and that we'll provide you with justice. But you, as part of that justice, be very well, you need to go to prison. But when they don't follow the law and we don't follow the law, then we're no different.
Over here.
Sorry, I'm having trouble because unfortunately I read a lot of history, and for almost a decade now I've been using a word that describes exactly the obscenities like Vitave and the other people from the Conservative Party of Canada led by the terrorist of all terrorists, Stephen Harper. I've been using the word fascism and fascist because what has happened in Canada in the last 10 years parallels on so many levels what took place in Germany. As good people, German people are good people, you know. They have families, they have kids, and they did before World War II. And they were good people, but they were apathetic and they were lied to and they were manipulated, just as we have. And yet nobody, I've been taken to task for using the word fascism. But that is the society we live in today. That is the reality we live in today. And I thank you for giving us some of the minute details of one of the aspects of fascism in our country today. And I'm so happy you came. Thank you.
Thank you for that. We're in agreement. If one looks at the civil society that was Germany pre-Second World War, I would suggest to you it's far more sophisticated than we were. They had a very, they had a parliamentary system, not the parliamentary system where we have, where there's no debate, where there's omnibus bills no one meets, and we scream and shout at each other. And then we had, then Germany had all kinds of arts and literature and freedom of religion, and a powerful police force and the judiciary. All those civil institutions we have today. And so I'm not here to give a history lesson, but there is a parallel. And the parallel is apathy is a virus. It's an evil. Unless you stand up and let people know what you stand for, as I earlier said, you stand up for justice, equality, humanity, then we'll have bills like C-51. If we think Bill C-51 is bad, wait till Harper gets elected in the next election. I can't keep track of the bills that have come out, considering the crime rate's gone down for the last 13 years. Thank you very much.
We'll take a question over here next.
Thank you.
So despite the Geneva Convention, time and time again, we've seen the U.S. get away with human rights violations. We saw it with in Vietnam, with their use of chemical warfare in Agent Orange. So my question is, because the U.S. seems to get away with it almost every single time, how do we as Canadians, I guess, how can we mobilize to kind of hold them to account?
We have to hold ourselves to account. I hear this all the time, not what your particular very good question, but I hear what I do. But what you do is, this is your society. Actually, I would tell you, if I were to start again, I wouldn't be speaking to adults. I'd be speaking to kids. I'd be sending them home to talk to their parents to make sure they did something. It's up to us to decide the kind of society we want. You know the kind of society you want. When you're living in your street and your kids are playing outside, you want them to be safe. You want them to have good values. That's the kind of society we are. And when we're not getting it, then we've got to get off our bum and talk to our politicians and talk to our neighbours. And if a politician is going to do what we want, then why not have a little hobby of knocking on every door in the neighbourhood to say, vote against this guy?
I just wanted, I don't have a question, I just came here to give you a gift. I heard you were coming out. It's a gift of, it's a little medicine drum with a buffalo on it, and a feather, and some medicine there, which we believe will protect you when your endeavors are here on it.
Chance, I happened to read last year a little book by a Scottish minister, I think it was Church of Scotland. He had spent the 1930s, here in Winnipeg and had been sent by his church to France for the Second World War years, where he acted like the Scarlet Pimpernel and was part of an underground movement to rescue Allied forces that were behind lines and get them back to where they could fight again. And of course, he was caught. And he detailed the tortures that he himself and others went through at the hand of the SS. And the only one that was similar was carrying buckets of water by wounded soldiers and prisoners all night long. And as you described the wounds weeping, it was the same in this book. All the other tortures sound like a picnic next to what you've described here this evening. I'm not shocked, because I did know before, but reassaulted in my senses that this should happen to a child. This should happen to anyone. That we should be complicit in this in any way, shape, or form. And like you said, it's time to knock on doors and get rid of our own little Nazi. Mm-hmm. And take down the rest. It is time we got off our television sets and the internet and stopped playing in our gardens, you know, with our weed killer, and did something before we don't have any land for the Métis, like myself, or the rest of the Aboriginal people, or any of the rest of you, because this is a horrible situation. And I'm sorry it was a statement, not a question. I had 1,000 questions for you, but I just think you're...
Thank you. Thank you very much. You know, it, One of the things I should say about torture is, contrary to people's beliefs, that if one got tortured, that person's going to come after you with a gun, sail across the ocean, climb into your house and shoot you. I heard all that kind of language when I was being in the United States under the Bush administration. So I made my way from Edmonton to Guantanamo. I had all the language of fear. But the reality of torture of victims, and I've met, unfortunately, quite a few, is that they find a humanity that we don't understand. I was in Argentina and dealing with the chief prosecutor of Buenos Aires, and he's putting up military junta to trial, and during the dirty wars down there, there's a great deal of torture took place. So, you know, I met a Nobel Peace Prize winner who had been tortured. I met all kinds of people who had been tortured, and they say the same thing that Omar Khadr said in Guantanamo, is, I never want to see anybody harmed like me. Because I remember saying to Omar in Guantanamo years ago, so what do you want to do when I get you out of here? And Omar said, I want to be a doctor. And I said, why? I thought you wanted to be a lawyer. and he said, because I want to make sure that no one is ever harmed. And if you listen closely to his press conference, he made a comment about how he has experienced, played it very quietly, but he said, I've experienced pain. And so the human condition is beautiful and puzzling. Out of hell, you can become a better person. I can only give you the example of myself, although my wife may stand up and tell you I'm a bit of a pain to live with and be telling lies. My journey has made me more compassionate, not bitter. My journey has made me feel a better person about myself. I really feel that standing up for someone in the street who falls and helps and picks them up, and someone who needs help, makes me a better person. And so I have been blessed with the people like yourselves that I've met. People like yourselves have come in here, expressed your feelings, left your house. The human family is beautiful. We don't see it often enough, but it's beautiful. Thank you.
You've been listening to Dennis Edney speaking to an audience at the Broadway Disciples United Church in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, on June 19, 2015. You can download this program from the Global Research website. Just go to globalresearch.ca and look under the Global Research News Hour tab and find it under the heading Dennis Edney, The Rule of Law and the Politics of Fear. For CKUW, this is host and producer Michael Welch. Please stay tuned for your next regularly featured radio program.